Come on, Higgins. You don't look up Javert in the Yellow Pages.
That's right. It would have to be somebody in the community.
Community?
Intelligence field.
Community? Jesus, you guys are kind to yourselves. Community. I pick up traces of what I think's an intelligence network the company doesn't know about. And I report it. Now, why is that going to make anybody mad, Higgins? Unless it was the company's network and you didn't want it blown, not even to your own guys. Now, somebody is lying, Higgins. Come on. Why is everybody so shy?
I'm not shy.
Do you trust him?
Trust.
But does he trust you?
He's in the suspicion business. He can't trust anybody.
But they all are. How could anybody sneak in and fool?
Maybe nobody did.
Then...
maybe there's another CIA. Inside the CIA.
So, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday, the 26th of August, 2022, just the beginning of the bank holiday weekend, August bank holiday weekend, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also, we're live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. I'm Tony Gosling, so thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda, and also, of course, the boring old COVID medical misinformation, where an estimated 60,000 Brits died without getting any treatment, even though it was there available, 35p for a tablet of ivermectin. And those London media lies all forgotten, are they? Anyway, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, as preached by the Maharishi himself, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the first part this week, we speak to Julian Assange's barrister, who's been with him right the way through from the initial accusations from Sweden and his house arrest, right the way through the Ecuadorian embassy, and now through these... also these extradition hearings. That's Jen Robinson. We also look at this murder up in Liverpool. Well, is it murder or manslaughter? If you shoot through a door and it ends up killing somebody by mistake, is that murder? We shall see. But there's been all sorts of questions about the practice of Merseyside police, particularly not even now giving out the name of the guy that they've arrested, suspecting. I mean, why is it that if they suspect somebody, they can't give their name, they can't put out a description? What are they playing at? This is the first job of the police, and several journalists, such as myself and others, have been discussing what are the police playing at. If they're after some gunman, why can't they give a description? A height, you know, a build, maybe an accent, if he has an accent, you know, that kind of clothes he's wearing, or this sort of thing, his name, if they know it, but they don't seem to want to. Their whole thing is, oh, we're going to try and guilt trip the criminal fraternity into turning him over. Well, what a joke these Merseyside police are. We're going to hear more about how awful Merseyside police have been, at least in the past, by innocent road rage victim Jack Beecham, who came across one of the most corrupt chief superintendents in the UK, a guy called Mr. Clohaty. And also, in part two, COVID, Ukraine and Israel, author Greg Felton on the deep state muscle flexing. After recovering from a heart attack a few weeks ago, in an exclusive talk he did for our journalist group, Holding the Line, last weekend. We have some clips from him, and also I'll be putting up the full talk interview, it turned out to be, at the end. It was a Q&A as well, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight, as well as making the video of the talk public as well. And also, assassinated a week ago, Alexander Dugin's daughter. By whom, though, and why? We speak to David Livingstone on her father, the Rasputin-like alleged advisor to Putin. That is Alexander Dugin. So Daria Dugin is the one assassinated. Her father is potentially, anyway, the target as a close advisor to Putin. And we hear at the end a bit from Dr. Zelenko, the great philosopher, I call him. And well, he's a doctor, medical doctor, and Orthodox Jewish critic of the poison death jab. One family, the Zelenko family, that Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, Adolf Eichmann and Stefan Bandera missed. So that's tonight, Iranian and Russian news has all been firewalled, censored, cancelled here in the West. First by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom 2. And we were cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and our boss, Pat Hart, but not cancelled here so far. So, Martin, I think maybe we should start by looking at this murder up in Merseyside. I mean, you're actually from that part of the world, weren't you? It's pretty horrific. The idea that there's some sort of altercation going on in the street last weekend. I think it was Monday, wasn't it? And or Sunday evening. And someone chases someone through a door, gets shot. Is this just what we have to expect in Merseyside these days?
Well, it's the first shooting in Bristol, it's called Bristol, Liverpool, for quite a while, and that's why it's made the news.
Well, no, there were several others, actually, this year.
Yes.
And another one, they've just announced today that they've got a suspect has been arrested for that one, too. So there's several this year. Last year wasn't too bad. This year there's been quite a few killings.
Yeah, obviously what makes this newsworthy is the death of the 9-year-old girl, which is quite rightly shocking. And I've been hearing about what's been happening. I think, yeah, I don't have enough information to have a strong view, other than it's a bad thing.
Well, I think we all know that. Come on, Martin, can't you do better than that?
Well, you want me to denounce the Liverpool
Not
police?
Not really, no. I'm saying, why are we in a situation where something like this can just happen?
Because people with guns, and they are out there.
What's the social,
when you shoot guns, social, people get killed.
What's the social background to all of this?
Why the social this? Background to this, and Liverpool gets a reputation as a place where this sort of thing goes on. You think, remember Jamie Bulger, some many years ago, murdered by teenagers? Liverpool has got some of the most deprived parts of the whole country are in Liverpool. It's a city which has been devastated by decades of Tory neglect and, frankly, vindictiveness. And the locals are very proud and very, Boris Johnson said that they've got a victim mentality. And don't forget, we know that Oliver Letwin, after the first round of rioting in 1981, he in the cabinet said, well, why don't we just let Liverpool die? People in Liverpool are very well aware of that sort of attitude towards them down south. And of course, in Liverpool, the Labour Party remains the dominant force. And it's never been removed from that dominant position.
Well, we're going to hear a bit more about police corruption now over there, and from up in Merseyside, from a guy called Jack Beecham, who I spoke to this week, and I'll let him explain what originally happened 13 years ago in his own words.
I was parked my car in a lay-by outside my dentist on the Whittle. The lay-by was at the side of a two-lane each-way road, main road, and at the end of the lay-by, there was a set of traffic lights, and as I got out of my car to shut the car door, the traffic lights turned to red. It's in Prenton, on the Whittle, which is a major road not far away from Tranmere Rovers football ground. It's outside a set of shops where the Sainsbury's, a large Sainsbury's superstore that's there, the other side of the traffic lights. So this happened at 5 o'clock on a Thursday night, on May the 27th, 2010. And as I was getting out of my car to shut the car door, the traffic stopped alongside me, inches away, about 12 to 14 inches away. And a silver Mondeo car was immediately alongside me. As I went to turn to shut my car door, a gust of wind blew, and before I could grab hold of the door, and blew my door to hit the plastic bumper of the Mondeo car. I looked at the Mondeo car and saw no damage whatsoever, so I grabbed the door and shut it and then locked it. And as I was walking round to the pavement, a man got out of this particular car, just an ordinary man in ordinary clothes with sunglasses on, and he started shouting at me quite aggressively. And he said, "Oi, you, stop there. You just criminally damaged my car." And I put my hands up and said, "Whoa, hang on, I haven't criminally done anything. I'm not that type of person." He said, "Well, you've got to stop there." He said, "I want your insurance details." And I said to him, I said, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm prepared to give you my insurance details, but I've seen no damage. So I said, if you don't mind, I'm locked up and parked in a lay-by at the back of my dentist. There's an Aldi Stoke Home Base car park. I said, I can walk down to the back of the shops and meet you there because you're on the main road and blocking the traffic. He said, no, you've got to stop here. And he grabbed my arms. And I said to him, don't grab me. And he took his hands off immediately. He said, I'm a policeman. Now, if you put yourself in my shoes, my car door has knocked against a silver Mondeo plastic bumper. And he's an ordinary person in ordinary clothes with sunglasses on. He didn't look anything like a policeman or even act like it with his aggression towards me. The only thing that would have made you think that he possibly could be a policeman was by using the words criminally damaged my car. So I said to him, I said, no, I said, I'd like to meet you at the back. As I was saying that, his mobile phone went off in his pocket. He grabbed his mobile phone and was talking on his mobile phone. And at this time, it was 5 o'clock at night, so there's a lot of cars at rush hour were starting to beep their horns because he's blocking the road, or the inside lane of the road. And I was getting quite embarrassed, so I gestured to him with my fingers. I'd be walking down to the back of the shops and meet him there. Halfway down the alley to the back of the shops, a voice loudly shouted from behind me. And immediately, a hand grabbed my neck and spun me around. I'm 5'7", and at the time, 60 years old, or nearly 60 years old. He's I've discovered since, he's 6'2", and was 43 years old at the time. So there's a great difference in height and strength and everything there. So I pushed him off as he grabbed me by my neck, and we got to the end of the alleyway where the home bargain shops and Aldi shops were, and he's grabbing me and pushing me up against the fence, and he gets his hand and puts it around my throat, and he's choking me so that I couldn't breathe. Now, at this time, if you put yourself in other people's shoes and looking at it, it's just a tall man grabbing a little old man, pushing him up against the fence and choking him. Now, there were lots of shoppers inside the shops who could see what was going on, and they were banging on the windows to him. Because I couldn't breathe, I'm hitting the hand that's around my throat. And I happened to have my car keys in my hand, but I wasn't even thinking about that because I just wanted to breathe. And he then said to me, as I hit him with my hand, which had the keys in, I'm now going to arrest you for assaulting a police officer in the execution of his duty. And I then managed to get his hand, and he's just got his elbow against my chest, still up against the fence. I'm not fighting or anything with him, but he's being that aggressive to me. So he goes on his mobile phone again, and he's ringing up. I couldn't make out exactly what he was saying. But whilst he was ringing up, a lady comes by who's a neighbour of mine who happens to work in the police as a typist. And she said to this man, neither of us knew at that point in time he was a policeman. She said, what are you doing to this man? He said, I'm a policeman. And she said to him, well, I think you're using unreasonable force against this man. He said, no, I'm not. And he carried on with his phone call. And literally within 8 minutes, 16 police cars with 32 policemen arrived at this car park, swarming the car park with all these policemen to grab hold of me, basically, which they put me in handcuffs and threw me in the back of a police car. At the same time, a CSI van arrived to take paint samples off my car, which is quite ridiculous, really. But at that point in time, I then believed he probably was a policeman.
So that's Jack Beecham there with a description of what happened to him back in 2010. It does seem, Martin, sometimes with the police, if they're cowardly, corrupt or whatever, that it's a lot easier to go and beat up an innocent member of the public than it is to take on the real criminals.
Well, that sounds like, to me, totally unprofessional behaviour. which ought to have led to him being dismissed from the police force.
Well, he has. He's actually taken retirement now. And also, as Jack went on to explain in the long interview, the chief constable that was protecting Chief Superintendent Cloherty has also had to leave the Merseyside police force. But there is certainly a culture there of cover-up and corruption within the police. Now, I mean, obviously, we need to have a police force in order to investigate murders and things like that. But number one, we're hearing over the last week or so the utter incompetence of them not issuing descriptions or anything of the man that they're supposedly trying to get hold of for this murder of this young girl, Olivia. So they're not issuing descriptions. They rather put out statements saying, oh, please, Criminal Fluency, please tell us who it is. You know, this is just not professional policing. So there was also a case, which I talk about in this, because I was looking it up at the time, about 10 years ago, of a young man who was also killed in Liverpool. And the local police were supposedly doing a similar thing, you know, investigating it, putting out appeals. And yet the locals were putting the name of the killer, graffitiing it up all around the area. They knew exactly where it was, but the police were pretending they didn't know. So anyway, what happened with Jack is when he went through, and I'll put a link up to the excellent Liverpool Echo article about the Crown Court case where he was finally an appeal against his being convicted for in the magistrates' court for these this offence, alleged offence anyway, of opening a car door and touching the plastic bumper of a Mondeo, which was a plainclothes police, off-duty policeman, superintendent, was in. And he found out at this court case, another policeman came and sat next to him and explained to him, see, this is not the only thing that this guy has been up to.
And Mr. Hussein said to me, Mr. Beecham, he said, I can tell you something else about Mr. Cloherty. He said, whilst I was with him, he was known for his road raids. When we were out in the roads, in the cars, which I have been many times with him, he's aggressive, and he said he met a group of people one particular night, and he was just very nasty and hollow, and drove at them one particular day, and so they'd run away. He said one day in Shaw Street in Liverpool, there was four girls crossing the road in Shaw Street, which is a 30 miles an hour road, and this police, unmarked police car, was zooming down way above the 30 mile an hour speed limit, and it hit, Mr. Hussein told me this, he said it hit one of the girls, a young girl called Kelly Edgar, her name. I know her sister Leanne now, that's why I said Leanne, so sorry about that. So Kelly Edgar was 11 years old, and she got hit by Mr. Cloherty's unmarked police car. Her head hit the windscreen, smashing his windscreen, and he carried her on his bonnet for about 27 metres before she was thrown off into the street, and he came to a halt 57 metres away. Now, the RAC guidance for a car driving at 30 miles an hour, it would stop within 20 metres. Stopping 57 metres away, he must have been driving, according to the RAC, at over 55 miles an hour at the point in time.
What happened to this young woman?
She died. She died two or three days later in hospital in Liverpool. And that's where Mr. Hussein comes in, because that was a Saturday night, and on the Monday morning, with his sergeants and two other police officers who was in the same team as Mr. Cloherty, they were all asked to go with the sergeant to Mr. Cloherty's house in Formby, where he lives, to visit him. He still lives there today. And he said, Jack, he said, I sat on the couch in Mr. Cloherty's front room there with our sergeant doing the talking only. And he said to him, Mike, don't worry. This, you won't be affected by all of this. We will make sure. And he said, I've been wrestling with that for many years. He said, I can't, when I know that young girl has died. It turns out he wasn't going to any scene, which is why he was driving over the limits. He was, with his road rage, he was racing another policeman who was on St. Anne Street back to the police garage to get their own cars to go home at 8 o'clock that Saturday night. And obviously, because he's hit this one girl, that was you know, that's what happened, basically. And then, apparently, what I'm told by the family, because I met the family last year, Kelly's father, a year later at the graveside, tried to hang himself. And unfortunately, one of the family got there and found and got him, sort of thing, before it happened. Her mother died a few years ago, heartbroken that the police had got away with this all, because it turns out Mr. Cloherty was charged with careless driving at that point in time. And when it came to, this is what the family have told me in the past 12 months, when it came to the day of the decision by the Liverpool Magistrate Court of all things, a young girl died. It turns out that the last day of the hearing, it was a closed court. The public couldn't come in. And on the last day of the hearing, one of the family members has said that it was discovered that the police had lost the paperwork of the driving incident and the miles an hour and all the other things against Mr. Cloherty. So in that case, the judge dropped the case against him.
So that's Jack Beecham there, and I'll put a link up to the full interview with Jack, which is about an hour long, telling his entire story of the various court cases, pinging backwards and forwards, a retired judge coming out of retirement to oversee the case where this police officer was finally convicted, this Chief Superintendent Cloherty. And quite amazing, isn't it, to hear that because of this particular case, other people came forward and spoke to Jack about various other things that this maniac officer had done. Now, I suppose the question here, Martin, is how do we like to have confidence in the police? And in fact, Jack starts the interview by talking about how he did have confidence as a young man in the police. What's clearly going on in Merseyside and quite possibly in other forces is that when an officer does break the law in a very serious way, which is embarrassing for the force, that there is this clique mentality at the top which protects them. And that, of course, can destroy families like the family we've just heard about here, who had their daughter killed by this maniac officer driving in a plainclothes car, or whatever they call them, unmarked car, 50 miles an hour down a road, and just, you know, knocked her down and killed her. And he's not going to be prosecuted for it at all because he's lost the paperwork, apparently.
Well, it's a very disturbing series of events, isn't it? In theory, all of those things are criminal behaviour by the police officer concerned, and he shouldn't just be dismissed, he should also be prosecuted. In practice, we know that there is sometimes a culture of cover-up and complacency in police forces.
But it's a criminal culture, actually, that's developed in Merseyside Police. One does wonder if anything's really changed since these days, where officers are much more prepared to protect the people they chit-chat with in the canteen than they are to actually do their job.
Well, that's always been an issue. I lived in Brixton in 1981 and 1985, when the riots broke out. And of course, in 81, Toxteth, there was riots. And that's because the relationship with the police, with the young people in particular, have deteriorated to an incredible extent. I could tell you lots of stories about unprofessional behaviour by Brixton Police Force. Because I was a young man at that time, and I came into some of the attention.
So you think we've got a bit of rose-tinted glasses that we're looking at the past? Because Jack's saying that when he was a young man, that the police were respected by the teenagers, etc., and that they felt that they were there as a force for good.
Well, the Scallies have always been up against the Busies in Liverpool. You know what the Scallies are and the Busies, don't you, Tony? Well, the Scallies are the young lads and the Busies are the coppers. And in actual fact, there's a lot of social problems in Liverpool are bad because it was deindustrialised by the Tories in the early 80s, and it became, it's still, Knowsley in Liverpool is the part of the country most deprived, and it's the one that received most austerity during the Osborne era.
I was
era.
Particularly disgusted by the coverage by the London media during the week, not by the Liverpool Echo, by the London media during the week of this Liverpool killing of this young girl, Olivia, mainly because the way it was all portrayed as some sort of random thing. It clearly wasn't a random thing. There was a criminal argument going on out in the street. The mum came out to have a look at what was going on. And then when one of the protagonists saw that a door was open, he decided to run in and to try and hide in the house. And that's when the little girl got killed. But there was clearly descriptions around of the gunman. The police just decided they didn't want to share those with people. But the media
arrested somebody today.
Well, they have today. They still haven't given a name.
Are they
scared to give people's names?
Well, look,
if they're after somebody.
I would suggest it's an operational decision for them, and they've actually got the guy.
If they want the guy, if they want the guy, it makes sense to give out a name, doesn't it?
Not necessarily, Tony. If you've already got a good idea who it is, and you've got another mechanism.
And you know who it is? You might be able to dob him in, mightn't you?
Well, you might. I mean
that's what the police generally do. If they are trying to find somebody... Yeah, look, I know you don't like this, but if the police are trying to find somebody, they would give out a name and a description. That will help them find them, won't it?
They've found him without that. That's an operational decision of the police officers.
May they have found him earlier? I mean, this is just normal. Certainly when I was doing reporting on these sorts of cases back in the 1990s, if the police are after somebody, the first thing they do is issue a description. And as soon as they get a name, they'd issue a name. So that helps them to trace the person. So anybody that knows them knows who they are. Particularly, you know, there seems to be a game being played here by the press and the police with the public in that particularly... The idea is that this is just a random thing. Oh gosh, isn't it awful? Someone could burst into anybody's house and do this. Well, it isn't quite the same as talking about the level of drug crime and criminal activity in an area. And also, of course, the social side of this, Martin, which I was trying to egg you on to talk about, which is the fact that as part of this whole cost of living crisis, austerity measures, what we've seen is people going to more and more desperate measures in order to try and get money. And that includes a massive recruiting sergeant for criminal gangs and organised crime.
These wider social issues are obviously bearing on the whole situation. When I don't know if you saw that a few months ago now, the police managed to crack an encrypted network that was used by international drug cartels. And in actual fact, it turned out that the Liverpool gangsters were at the top of the tree. And they're very successful. And of course, the problem here is that drugs should be legalised. And that's what's going to possibly happen in Colombia, where they've got a new Petro, the new left-wing leader in Colombia, is saying, we're not going to pursue this war on drugs. But of course, you know who's opposed to stopping, that's moving in that direction. That's where most Latin America wants to go. That's where Almo wants to go in Mexico. The opposition to that comes from the Americans.
You know what it also comes from? Organised crime. Organised crime don't want this stuff decriminalised, do they?
Of course they don't, because the only way to make money off it, if it's illegal. If it was legal, it would actually be a rather work-a-day sort of a product, which the profit margins would be relatively small.
So organised crime are patting the Tory cabinet on the back, saying thank you very much for making sure that this whole world stays illegal, just as we have prohibition of alcohol in America.
It's worse than that, Tony, because in actual fact, the CIA and MI6 are heavily involved in the drugs trade as a means of funding their various proxy armies. And that the records around this is overwhelming. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, if you remember him, the Iran-Contra scandal, what he was doing was working with Adolfo Calero, the head of the Contras in Nicaragua, to bring massive amounts of Colombian cocaine into the United States to fund the terrorist war against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. Now, when Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North is sent to prison as a terrorist and a drug dealer, I will take... zero tolerance as a serious policy. But since he's actually a hero on Fox News and various other right-wing shows in the United States, I just think the whole thing stinks from the top to the bottom. And of course, the deindustrialisation of Liverpool, the demonisation of the Liverpool people like at Hillsborough, these are all factors in discussing a case like this. But it's also just extremely sad. And, you know, it's what can one say, you know? A 9-year-old girl is dead. Terrible.
Well, I just think we need a very, very close look at the police. And I mean, what Jack was saying is that they've got some sort of informal group of citizens who are victims of the police criminal gang, they call them, in Liverpool, who are doing whatever they can to point out that some of the senior appointments, and it is generally the senior appointments, chief superintendents, chief constables, people like that, are people who've been involved in criminal cover-ups in the past, Martin.
Well, we know that there's a big issue with the Metropolitan Police, don't we? That guy who murdered Sarah Everard, and the you know,
also, well, Neil Bass, who's his boss, yeah. That's a whole other. So that's the anti-terrorist branch, which is associated with the Met.
Yes.
Now they are the people that turn up, for example, turned up in Salisbury, didn't they, to do all the investigation around the Skripal?
Yes. So in other words, the police are. They've got what you might call petty criminality and back scratching. Although we've had police officers on this show, Tony, and all policemen and police officers should not be regarded in that light. It is inevitable that you're going to have people in the police who shouldn't be there. It attracts that kind of person, like the military, and it's a constant battle. I mean, you know, I've not watched Line of Duty, but you will be aware that corruption is a major factor in law enforcement. It's bound to be. The criminals want to get away with it, and the cheapest and easiest way to get away with it is pay the cops off, isn't it? So it's just the way of the world.
Well, the austerity latest, or cost of living latest, or collapse of the UK latest, whatever you want to call it, is here in Bristol. We have news this week that Bristol Community Transport has axed the Lifeline bus service amidst the cost crisis. Vital community bus services used by hundreds of vulnerable people in Bristol are axed from today. Bristol Community Transport has announced that its dial-a-ride service and community minibuses, which had been a lifeline for elderly and disabled residents, will stop operating despite desperate last-minute efforts to find alternative providers. The West of England Metro Mayor Dan Norris says a big question mark now hangs over BCT's dozen mainstream bus services, although the M1 Metro bus, well, that's one of the big flagship bus services of the whole city, although really we wanted a tram. We got this kind of bus, basically, called a Metro bus, which is just a bus, really, is understood to be safe. In a statement on Tuesday, the social enterprise organisation said, "We regret to announce that Bristol Community Transport will no longer be in a position to deliver community transport services in Bristol, including dial-a-ride and minibuses for groups." Now, this has been going for many years. One does obviously think that if the Bristol City Council hadn't wasted this £50 million, poured it all down the drain on Bristol Energy, Martin, you know, a few bob could have gone to Bristol Community Transport to save it.
Well, I presume that the problem for Bristol Community Transport is the price of petrol. And if they're a separate standalone organisation, this is going to be a problem for all sorts of organisations. I was reading about schools, which now manage their own budgets. Head teachers are now going to have to budget for having a big increase in expenditure on energy, but they're not being given any more money by the government. What we really need is for all of these energies, schools, buses, to be run by the government with no private sector involvement at all and no profit and loss accounts that make any difference, because you can subsidise losses in some parts of the system with profits in other parts of the system, like we used to do with the Royal Mail.
No, actually, just reading through the article, what looks like has happened here is there's been a slow withdrawal of public subsidy for these bus services over the last 10 years. And, of course, that's in line exactly with the Conservative government withdrawing funding from local authorities.
Well, there you are. So it's a two-pronged attack. This crisis over the winter is going to find all sorts of organisations are going to find it. You see all this stuff about individual families, it's bad enough, but businesses are going to be hammered by all of this. We're going to have a recession which will turn into depression, and we need radical solutions. So, for example, there's some argument that I was reading one of Corbyn's advisors saying today it's cheaper to nationalise all of it. Well, but that means we've got to accept that everything we've done since 1979 was wrong. And, of course, it was wrong.
Yep.
Stupid.
Well, it was greedy because certain people got their fingers in the tills, didn't they? And they've still got them. And as the tills start to run out, then they just run off. Well, Bristol Lib Dems believe that consideration should be given, they say, to the West of England Combined Authority purchasing Bristol Community Transport to protect the services it provides. That's the Lib Dems in the city.
Well, they are. I mean, in a sense, that makes sense. I mean, having standalone social enterprises which run their own budgets means that they can go bust. Whereas if they're part of the provision of local services by the local council, they can't go bust. And I used to work in the social economy section in Bristol City Council. And, you know, in many ways, what social enterprises do is, or they can do in the worst cases, is they just create a veneer that public money is not being involved here, and it's somehow some kind of third sector which is not dependent on public funds. Now, some social enterprises, cooperatives, for example, are a genuine third sector. They've got a different ownership structure and so on. But a lot of social enterprises are, in fact, government provided services provided through an intermediary. And there's no particular reason to have an intermediary. What about if the government's spending
the
money?
We've heard about Bristol Community Transport there. What about energy firms? Because Carla Denyer, who's the leader of the Greens in Bristol here, is saying Greens are calling for energy firms to be brought under public ownership. We're seeing a nationwide anxiety about the prospect of unpayable energy bills this winter. The Green Party's call for Big Five energy suppliers to be brought into public ownership, for the price of energy to be returned to where it was in October 2021 to protect households from accelerating costs. The current energy price cap set in April, currently at £1,971. Experts in Cornwall Insight predict a jump to nearly £3,600. Gosh, that's nearly doubling again in October, when the price cap will next be reviewed. Now, these people doing the price cap seem to be working for the energy companies, don't they?
Well, don't forget that the whole idea of having price caps was only because Ed Miliband pushed for it back in the day, and the Tories didn't even want to have price caps. The fact is, the Green Party are right to say that these utilities should be renationalised. And I think that they are basically appealing on to voters or to the left of the current Labour leadership, who are saying that they've ruled that out. I mean, it was Rachel Reeves, shadow chancellor, she went to Liverpool, of all places, to announce that we wouldn't be renationalising anything, even though Starmer had promised that he was going to stick to the manifesto that fought the last election on, because there's no money because of the pandemic. Now, that is exactly the wrong argument. What the pandemic has shown is that the government can, if it wants to, intervene in the economy in a very powerful way.
So has this
and people
really
can see that it can be done. The idea that there is no money is wrong. There's obviously enough money to do anything you want to do. You've just got to decide you want to do it.
Has there been any discussion about this in the leadership? I mean, this is the key issue, isn't it? The idea of whether the government is actually going to be able to do anything or not. I mean, if you've got a leader of the Conservative Party, a new leader, it doesn't really make any difference if they can't do anything. And the most important things that they will be doing, obviously, is pressing various buttons for the Americans in terms of wars in Ukraine or wherever else the Americans want us to have a war. That seems to be their main function nowadays, as a sort of spokesperson for the Pentagon, in Downing Street. But these key issues are things like whether or not these things are going to be in public ownership, and whether the government can say, well, no, we are going to make sure that people can actually heat their homes this winter.
Well, obviously, in right-of-centre Russia, Gazprom is owned by the Russian government. In Norway, left-of-centre Norway, Statoil is owned by the Norwegian government. In this country, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak are arguing about how much tax cuts the middle class should have.
What I find amazing,
that's what they think the important issue
is listening to the private sector, Talk TV and GB News and other outlets in the private sector talking about nationalisation.
That's because it's the overwhelming opinion polls show that even Conservative members, never mind Conservative voters, think that national industry should be nationally owned. And in actual fact, that's quite a Conservative position.
Yeah, I know, but
that's what we used to do.
That means the whole country.
We've stopped doing it.
If the Tories, the Tory members are onto this too, then the whole country wants this.
Yes.
Apart from two people. One is named Liz Truss, and the other one is Rishi Sunak.
And the other people who don't want it are the City of London and the funders of the Conservative Party. And, of course, the Starmer wants to keep those people on side as well, because he's hoping that business will fund the Labour Party. Now he's ruined its finances by paying out to the pro-Israel lobby. So, in other words, it is very indicative of the lack of democracy in this country that basic stuff like why don't we renationalise all this and everybody agrees that it should be done, it can't be done because the City of London and the oligarchy don't want it.
Well,
they've
occupied the various positions.
And of course,
the other thing is, if
we start moving in this direction of renationalising things, they are terrified. Where's this going to end? And of course, where it should end is with the renationalisation.
French Revolution.
That everything should be renationalised. Well, I mean, it needs to be renationalised. And that's a hell of a lot of stuff.
We are looking at strikes, aren't we? Increasingly, the post office workers on strike today, the Royal Mail people. You know, this is going on. And we've got barristers. I'll be hearing in a minute about the barrister strike. But one of the, well, every now and again, a story comes out and I just laugh and laugh when I see it. I look at this. This really does show the irony of this crazy world we live in. This week, the Daily Express did a poll. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak sent a warning as Tory voters want Boris to stay. Now, this isn't the members, this is the Tory voters. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak have been sent a warning after a new poll found voters want outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson to stay. Now, hang on a minute. Last month, as I remember it, we were being told by the Conservative MPs, mainly, obviously by the pundits and the right-wing press and the Tory-funded whoever, all the Tory side, was that Boris was actually going to be an impossible person to win the next general election. And so that's why, because of Partygate and various other things, the public thought he was such a disaster that they had to get rid of him. Now, at the time, I was saying, well, this looks more to me like a Treasury coup. Now, what we're hearing is that these Conservative voters have taken a look at this whole process to find a replacement. Be careful what you wish for, folks, when you wish Boris to go. The two contenders against him are worse. A poll published earlier this week showed 49% of Tory supporters thought Boris Johnson should remain Prime Minister. This is more than the combined support seen for both Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. Just 20% of the respondents supported Mr. Sunak. Meanwhile, 18% supported Truss. The remaining 12% of respondents were despondent, undecided. The latest polling is stark contrast to public opinion, supposed public opinion anyway, at the time of Mr. Johnson's resignation. So what the Tory party have managed to achieve here is to find two far worse politicians to run the country than Boris.
Now, we'll have to clarify a point here, Tony. We're talking about Tory voters, who Tory voters want. Now, that is not the general population.
No, but they're the ones who are going to decide. And also,
the Tory voters aren't going to decide. The Tory members are going to decide.
We know that, right? We all know that, Martin. The reason it's important that they're looking at Tory voters is that we were being told that the Tory party and the Tory supporters thought Boris Johnson was going to lose them the next election. It's quite clear that they've got two people now about to take over, one of them probably Liz Truss, who is even more likely to lose the next general election.
Now, let's just go through this step by step, Tony. This is a poll of Tory voters. Now, in actual fact, the number of Tory voters, people who say I'm going to vote Tory at the next election, has been going down. So quite a lot of people who used to vote Tory, obviously, voted Lib Dem in Amersham and Cheam and Lib Dem in North Shropshire. So in actual fact, those people no longer count as Tory voters. They were Tory voters. They were so disgusted with Boris Johnson that they're now Lib Dem voters. So they don't appear in this survey of people who are Tory voters. The reason why the Tory MPs got rid of Johnson was because of the smashing defeat in those two constituencies.
Would it be interesting if Boris was also on the ballot and that the Conservative Party members could choose between Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson? What they're suggesting here is that Boris would be back.
Yes, he would. He would. And that's the problem of having the politics of the country held to ransom by the Conservative Party, which is 180,000 people.
I mean,
they are making the decision. They are wealthy, middle-class people in the southeast of England.
No, they're the Red Wall seats, Martin.
No, there's not a big Tory membership in the Red Wall seats. The membership is concentrated in the southeast of England.
Voters in this part.
All right, well, the voters. The voters do decide in general elections.
They decide at the next general election.
Yes, and loads of former Tory voters clearly switched to the Lib Dems in Tory safe seats. That's why they got rid of Boris Johnson, because otherwise they ain't going to win. And of course, if they'd kept him, it would have been quite useful for the Labour Party. But I think Liz Truss is going to outdo him in terms of losing support.
I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, this seems to be the whole point.
The problem is the Tory Party itself is a corrupt institution,
and the Labour Party isn't.
The Labour Party is not perfect.
Politics itself is corrupt. Well, Martin, you know that.
Yes, and so is the police force, as we were discussing earlier. But that doesn't mean we get rid of the police, does it?
We're talking about politics now, aren't we?
Yeah, well, the police
and
is part politics of politics.
I look at this leadership election. I mean, I've been purposefully avoiding playing any of these sort of debates, because I find the whole thing so repulsive and pointless. But particularly because of this situation we've arrived at now, where the whole premise of having a leadership election has been overturned by this poll. Now, what you've got now, because look, Martin, I mean, if you get rid of Boris Johnson,
you've got to have a leadership election, haven't you? What else are you going to do? Just have nobody
the
in charge?
The whole premise for getting rid of Boris in the first place, which wasn't the Tory voters or the Tory members, it was a Treasury coup, as I said in the first place.
No, it wasn't a Treasury
coup. Yes, it was.
No, it wasn't.
It was Rishi Sunak started the ball rolling.
Rishi Sunak wanted...
And he's basically going around to the other MPs saying, look, I'm thinking about getting rid of Boris, and would you support me if I give you a role in the next government? Blah, blah, blah. It's a coup.
No, it's not a coup, Tony. It's politics. You could call it a coup, but that's just sort of, we could call it war. But it's just politics.
But it's not war, is it?
No,
it's a coup.
Well, it's not.
It's where you've been taken out, basically.
What is going to happen now, Liz Truss is actually defying the Treasury and saying she's going to cut taxes, but she's not...
who do you think's going to win?
It's pretty clear she's going to win. She's been...
Is there any difference between the two?
There is a difference between the two, because Rishi Sunak is promising the Tory faithful that he will cut taxes, but first of all, we're going to balance the books, which is wrong. Liz Truss is saying, to hell with balancing the books, and Boris Johnson would probably be the same, to hell with balancing the books, let's just spend the money and see what happens. Now, of course, you can do that.
But she's cutting taxes too.
She's not saying I'm going to cut public expenditure as well, but she is saying she's going to cut public expenditure as well. I've been looking at this through a very basic thing,
which is looking at the queues outside hospitals of accidents, queuing outside A&E. So the reason they're queuing is because there is a complete collapse in social care. Rishi Sunak and others in the previous government, however terrible ARS people, as I'm sure you would say, Martin, what they've done is they've sorted out a national insurance method of trying to pay for this social care so that those people in the hospitals can actually... Their care arrangements can be sorted out to free up some capacity in the hospitals so that the accident and emergency departments can start to fill up with people just arrived in ambulances again, and the whole system starts to work, so that if you, say, for example, fall down the street, have a heart attack, have an accident, your life is under threat, that you can actually get some treatment fairly quick rather than not. Now, neither of them really seem to be doing anything. Well, so we say Rishi Sunak seems to have taken this one a bit more seriously than this Truss. And I find it awful looking at it thinking I would like to see Rishi Sunak win, because Liz Truss seems to be the sort of person that will say anything she's told to say, whereas he at least has got some sort of understanding of the economy.
Well, they're both deluded about the economy. The Tory party as a whole is deluded about the economy. What were we discussing in the first part of the programme? Nationalisation, the obvious answer. The Greens can see it, but of course the Tories will never see it.
The whole country can see it. Now, particularly people of our age who can remember nationalised industries.
Yes, and I think it's true of Conservative voters as well. So in actual fact, that's an open goal the Labour Party could take, but they won't do it because they're also beholden to the vested interests and all the rest of it, which is why our politics is so stuck. It's why we need PR, but we won't go down that wormhole. The Rishi Sunak is saying that we've got to have more austerity and then we can have tax cuts. I would say from my side of the fence, there is no case whatsoever for tax cuts for wealthier people. You get rid of the national insurance increase because that's actually a tax on workers. And therefore, you could say, well, that was a bad decision to fund the NHS by taxing workers. You should be taxing wealth, not workers. But if you're going to get rid of the national insurance increase to help people, you're going to have to raise taxes somewhere else. In fact, there should be a massive campaign to crush tax evasion and all the rest of it. But you can't see the Tories doing that because their funders are exactly those people. Rishi Sunak, his wife, didn't pay a penny of tax in this country until it was pointed out. And then she ponied up the 30 grand she owed. These are the kind of people who are seriously wealthy. The Tory voters are not the seriously wealthy, but they're pretty well off. And many of them have got private health insurance. They don't use the NHS. It doesn't bother them. This is the pass that our politics has come to, where a wealthy minority have basically got veto power over what can happen and what can't happen in our country.
The other thing is we've had a bit of I don't know if you've seen the headlines about the crisis in funding in the Labour Party this week, Martin. All sorts of problems. They're actually the cupboard is bare
Well, you know why that is.
Lucky there's no general election looming, no, otherwise the Labour Party would have no money to fight it.
There's two reasons for that. One is because lots of people have left in disgust at the way Starmer is leading the party. The other is that they paid off all of these people who claim that they've been discriminated against by anti-Semitism, even though the lawyers of the party said if you go to court, they will lose. But they paid them off. That's why they've got no money.
Sounds like your party has been sabotaged.
It's always been sabotaged, Tony. It's always been the way. And until we get a PR system where we can vote for what we really want, we're stuck with playing this stupid game, which the establishment always wins. And that is because that's why this country, basically, has gone down. Down the drain.
Weak leader like Jeremy Corbyn who couldn't stand up for himself.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn did his best.
He wanted to play kumbaya politics. No, he didn't do his best.
No, Tony, you've got a beard like he has. It's difficult people in radio land to see this. I would like to see you do his job and see if you could do it
better. That's not what we're here to do. No, Tony, you've never become politicians.
No, I'm a politician, Tony. I'm an activist, Tony.
I'd like to see you do. If you had been in Jeremy Corbyn's shoes, how would you have dealt with the right wing anti-Semitism?
Do you know what I've done if I was Jeremy Corbyn?
Were you playing kumbaya with them?
What I would have done if I was Jeremy Corbyn, and I'm not, is I would have committed to PR. At stage one of the battle, which is what the New Zealand Labour Party did in the early 1980s, and that's how you play proper first-class rugby union. And the problem in this country is people are stuck in a rut. They can only think in one dimension. We've got to change the way we think about politics. It's not just a question of playing by the same old silly rules, and we've got to try and another, you know, fix bayonets, let's have another over-the-top charge up the middle. You've got to start thinking, hang on a minute, we need to invent tanks here, aircraft.
Okay, so what is the problem in the Labour Party then? Well, how are you going to fix it? How are you going to actually get some money in to fight an election? Because without money, you can't win an election.
Well, that's another thing, of course. We need to reform the funding of political parties. In Scandinavian countries, political parties are funded by the government to the extent of their political support. Outside money is not allowed. And, of course, in our politics in Britain, and even more in the United States of America, you have to raise billions to fight elections, and that means the billionaires decide what the result is. And how do you change that? I don't know. You have a system like in China where you just have a communist party in charge and there's no elections at all, and the billionaires get told what to do. Michael Hudson's been pointing at this out all along, that in actual fact what you really need to do is get the oligarchs out of politics, and that requires sometimes revolution. And of course the powers that be in China did come to power through a revolution. It wasn't just a kumbaya, was it, Tony?
No, it wasn't. What we'll do is we'll go straight to the interview with V Townsend this week. She's someone I've been interviewing once in a while over the last few years. But she phoned me up with a bit of distress this week that she doesn't think the police are taking something seriously enough. She had an eye operation and she believes she was violated while she was under the anaesthetic. So let's hear from her now.
And got the money together to pay for the eye operation. I then had a date for it, which was Saturday the 6th of August on 2022. The doctor, Dr. Gerges, is a lovely man, as was everyone, apart from the upstairs spire. They were up their own arses, but the receptionist down the bottom were lovely. The doctor was lovely. His assistant was lovely. Everything went well. Because I was so anxious and nervous about having my eyes done, went under anaesthetic. And so the first thing I done when I opened my eyes, I've been under general anaesthetic before, not experienced this. First thing I done when I come round from the anaesthetic was put my hand between my legs to adjust myself for some reason. I do not know why. First of all, I thought to myself, obviously, that it was because a catheter had been fitted. I noticed as well that on the when I went home and I can't remember if I brushed my hands through my hair or brushed my hair, but behind my right ear, my hair was stuck together, which I thought was very weird. Maybe it was something to do with putting cream on the eye and they totally missed. I do not know. I dismissed the comfort in my vagina as I just believed it to be the catheter and dismissed it. I had to phone my manager up, who obviously knows a lot more about this than I do, because we deal with lots of clients that have catheters and things, to see if that could be something with regards to how I was feeling. They said no. So I went to, drove up to the police, the one in Knoll, on the 15th, I believe, and it was shut. So I come home and I thought, no, I'm not going to give up. So I went up again on the 16th and spoke to a lady who was really quite nice, actually. She was good. I give her a due. She made me feel comfortable and didn't make me feel stupid in any way, shape or form. Advised me to phone up the doctors. So I did. The receptionist at the doctor's in Long Ashton was very nice. She obviously, I didn't say much. I just said about going under anaesthetic, coming to and noticing that something wasn't right down below, that something had happened. As a female, she obviously understood. They put me through to another female who I do not know how to say this without swearing. So I'm just not going to say it. She just wasn't nice. Made me feel totally stupid, said to me, basically, I took a long time with coming forward. I didn't know there was a time scale. Just literally made me feel stupid.
So have you got photos or whatever, bruises? Have you got any evidence for what you're saying? Or is
How? What? You expect me to bend over and take a picture of my vagina? How can I prove? How can I prove that I'm in pain? The only way I can do that is I have been told, because the woman at the horrible nurse lady said, I suppose you want to come in for a test then. I said, no, I have been humiliated enough. I'm not going to humiliate myself more. And what is a test going to prove? That there's no sperm inside? That doesn't make sense. I know I have been damaged. I know I am sore. I know to this day now I am still sore. Yeah, it sounds rubbish, I know, but I am not lying, and I know I am not lying.
So that's V Townsend there. Let's have a chat with her in a few weeks, see how she gets on. It's nice to think there's some people out there that feel that if they've got having a problem with the authorities, they think there's something going on that shouldn't be going on, you know, that Tony's there for first port of call. So thanks, V, for that, and we'll see how she gets on. You know, obviously, you're in a vulnerable position. If you're going into a private hospital, you're under anaesthetic, you're a single woman. Anything could happen in these sorts of situations, and you really do rely on the professionals around you to look after you and protect you. Maybe, you know, this is maybe people should have CCTV that they can watch afterwards to see what the hell's been going on. That's what she seemed to want. But anyway, we'll keep track of that story over the next few weeks. But anyway, now we're going on to, we talked a bit about strikes earlier, Martin, didn't we, to hear about the strike of barristers, which is going on and has been going on this week. So I spoke to Jennifer Robinson, who is Julian Assange's barrister, about this. Thought that she'd be a good person to ask what is going on.
Foremost, just to express my support for my barrister colleagues who are going on strike this week. So they are striking because of the, I would say, criminal cuts to legal aid budgets in this country, which means that if you are facing criminal prosecution, you are entitled to legal aid and to defence by a publicly funded defence barrister. The problem is that successive governments have massively cut those funds to the point where now my colleagues who are junior barristers at the criminal bar earn £13,000 a year. They earn below minimum wage because, and the hours that you pull as a criminal barrister and the detail of the work that you're doing is really challenging and difficult. But it means that it's difficult to survive as a criminal defence barrister in this country. They can't afford to live. They can't afford to, you know, pay their bills. They can't afford to do the job that they're passionate about. And not in just passionate about, to do the job that is absolutely required by the rule of law and justice in this country. And this means that there are thousands of cases backed up in the criminal justice system because we aren't properly funding the system. It means that thousands of people are in prison unjustly, many of them, because they're waiting for their trial. Our system is absolutely broken. And so if we continue to cut legal aid like this, there will be no barristers left to defend these cases. That is a terrifying prospect for anyone who gets caught on the wrong side of the law, and any of us could be at any time. We know it happens unjustly all the time. People make mistakes, the police make mistakes, people are wrongfully accused, And I certainly would like to know that if I was sent to prison, that there is a skilled and trained barrister who is properly funded to defend me against the state. And at this rate, we do not have that. And that's why they're striking.
Well, the Department for Justice would argue, sorry, we haven't got the money.
We have the money, just where are we putting the money?
That's a pretty simple answer from Jennifer Robinson there. Yeah, the long and short of this, Martin, is the only the rich and the criminals can afford a barrister these days.
Well, I mean, this is criminals who are being defended or people being accused of criminal offences. Well, it's quite clear that if you know, barristers can make money by doing other kinds of work, but the bread and butter of, you know, sending criminals to prison or making sure that they're not sent to prison if they're innocent is obviously a vital social function. And it's just, you know, penny pinching by successive governments.
Well, in this case, it seems like the criminals are being employed by the US government in the attempt to extradite Julian Assange. And on what I'll do on our show page, I'll put up a fascinating article from our very own journalistic thing called the Press Gazette. It's from 2020, actually. It's not a recent article, but it's extremely important when it comes to Julian's case. US informants were not harmed by WikiLeaks releases. The extradition trial has been told and presented evidence. Hundreds of thousands of leaked documents published by WikiLeaks caused no harm to US informants. Julian Assange's extradition hearing has been told. The organization's founder is wanted in the US to face 18 charges, including plotting to hack computers and breaching the country's Espionage Act. Now, this is why these people not being harmed is so key, Martin, because what the US is implying is, number one, that in fact they're doing some amazing leaps of imagination, as Jennifer will be telling us in a minute, is one of them is that Julian Assange is a US government military employee rather than a journalist. And the other one is that what his releases have done is actually harmed their agents out in the big wide world where they have proven that they haven't. So they're just lying. And this case is going on and on and on. But what do you make of these two assumptions that lies that the United States government has been telling in order to keep Julian Assange in Belmarsh and bring him over to be tried under the Espionage Act? Number one, that the main premise of what he's saying is that people have been harmed because of these articles that were written in newspapers and the release. And secondly, that he's actually a spy, not a journalist.
Well, the harm argument is very unacceptable to me, because in actual fact it turns out it was the Guardian's journalists who released unredacted documents which might have caused harm to their agents. But the Guardian, I think it was Luke Harding, they've not been prosecuted. Whereas in fact Julian Assange was very keen to make sure that the documents as released should be redacted in such a way that no individuals could be identified who might come to harm. And it's been proved in court, as you say, that nobody was harmed. Lots of people were harmed by the actions of the US government in attacking Iraq illegally and killing loads of people, torturing people, running a whole string of illegal prisons all over the world, etc. And the Espionage Act was originally passed in 1917 in order to repress the opposition to joining the First World War in the United States. And one of the main people prosecuted under it was Eugene V. Debs, who was leader of the Socialist Party and quite a large party at that time. He went to prison. Bill Hayward, who was one of the leaders of the Industrial Workers of the World, trade unionist, he had to flee to Russia to escape prosecution under the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act was an extremely controversial piece of legislation, even when it was first passed in 1917. And then, of course, in the 1960s, the Congress passed a law that made the Espionage Act extraterritorial. So anybody, anywhere, can be charged with espionage against the United States. It's a travesty, and it should have been thrown out of the magistrates' court before it even got to this stage. But we haven't really got a rule of law in this country, have we?
No, we don't have, certainly haven't. But some people like Jennifer Robinson, Julian Assange's barrister, are doing everything they possibly can in order to make sure that Julian is not extradited to the United States. One of the key issues, though, of course, is this business I was talking about there of whether or not Julian Assange is a journalist who's publishing leaked material or he's a leaker himself. This is what the Espionage Act is trying to say, that Julian Assange is doing the leaking. No, Chelsea Manning did the leaking, it seems. Anyway, I asked Jennifer Robinson about this knotty issue as to whether someone who's actually a publisher can be done as if they are someone who's leaking secret information from within the military.
The alleged source is Chelsea Manning. Julian has never confirmed that because he would never confirm who the sources are. But Chelsea Manning in the United States, who was a military intelligence military officer in Iraq, has since been arrested, prosecuted and convicted and admitted in her criminal trial that she provided the information to WikiLeaks. Now, it's an interesting point and an important point that you raise. Of course, you have people who work within government who have obligations of secrecy to the state can face prosecution under the Official Secrets Act and or the equivalent statute elsewhere, which in the US is the Espionage Act and associated statutes. But typically, we've never prosecuted journalists and publishers. There's never been a prosecution, at least under the modern legislation, under the Official Secrets Act, of a publisher, to my knowledge. There's never been a prosecution of a publisher in the United States under the Espionage Act. And that's because we identify there's an important distinction between someone who has that obligation of secrecy and the importance of journalists being able to report on secret government conduct. So we don't want to criminalize the ability of journalists to speak to people within government and to source information from whistleblowers who might be able to tell us that the government has been acting unlawfully or has stuffed things up or has not been doing their job. That's an incredibly important role in our democracy, that we have whistleblowers inside government who are willing to risk prison and to risk their jobs to show the world what's going wrong. And we must protect the ability of journalists to speak to those sources, access information from them, receive information from them, and to be able to publish it in the public interest. What this case is trying to do is alleging that Julian conspired with his source by speaking to him, her rather, then him, now her, speaking to her, talk to her about what access to information she has and asking her to provide it. Now, journalists do that in a national security context all day, every day, all over the world. And so by criminalizing Julian for having those communications with a source or seeking to, we are putting at risk all national security journalism. It is criminalizing the very act of journalism.
Well, that's also a threat to democracy generally, isn't it?
Absolutely. So we need a free and vibrant press for democracy to operate. We need to be able to hold governments to account. We especially need to be able to hold governments to account for actions which take place in secret, which are not subjected to judicial review or democratic accountability. It is very important that we protect whistleblowers and protect the ability of the media to report on it. Otherwise, we lose government accountability. And if we lose government accountability, then we lose our democracy. And WikiLeaks has been an incredibly important tool. Julian set this entire organization up motivated by what he saw happening in a post-9/11 world. Increasing surveillance, lying to the public about going to war, lying to the public about what was happening in the war. That's why the Iraq and Afghanistan publications by WikiLeaks have been deemed to be so important, because they showed us a more accurate picture. We were not being told the truth about what was happening in those conflicts, and the WikiLeaks publication showed us more of the truth.
That's Jennifer Robinson there talking about the incredibly sharp mind, talking about the difference between prosecuting somebody who's a journalist or a publisher rather than someone that's actually done the leaking is something absolutely unprecedented. Of course, Chelsea Manning, who did these leaks allegedly in the first place, has done his 7 years inside. I think don't even served that full term. So the question has got to be raised. I mean, if Julian had gone along with this whole thing and gone, you know, maybe even over to Sweden, been arrested, sent to the States, done the Espionage Act stuff, he may even have been released by now, but that's not the way they're planning it. It's not the way Julian wants it. It's not the way his advisors and lawyers want it. But But anyway, how's the next question I asked Jennifer Robinson, Julian Assange's barrister, was how's the case been progressing? What's the latest on how this is all moving forward?
We've been challenging his extradition in the court. So we have been fighting extradition to the United States using the legal system in this country. And in early 2020, we won the first case. And a judge found that Julian's extradition to the United States would be should not happen because it would be oppressive. And she found that it would be oppressive because of the severe decline in his mental health and the depressive conditions that he suffers from because of the decade of mistreatment that he has suffered, that he would commit suicide if he was placed under the prison conditions he will face in the United States, which is the deepest dark black hole of the prison system, as it's called, or under special administrative measures, or SAMs, as they're known technically. Now, so the US appealed and they won. They shifted the goalposts, offered an assurance saying, well, we won't put him in those prison conditions unless he does something else to upset us. And the courts waved it through, so his extradition was ordered. It's now up to us to challenge that extradition again on the grounds of all of our outstanding appeal points. So we will be challenging the extradition on the grounds of, for example, abuse of process, that this is a political trial, that the US has misrepresented the facts in order to seek his extradition, that this is a flagrant violation of our free speech protections and Julian's free speech protections to seek to put him in prison for the rest of his life. These are just some of the arguments that we'll be raising. It's about to go back before the High Court. We're seeking permission for appeals shortly, and it remains to be seen. It could be going on for the next couple of years, potentially longer. And really, we talk about this as a form of punishment by process, because Julian has been under some form of restriction on his liberty since I walked him into a police station in December 2010. It's almost my entire professional life. It's 12 years of his life. And now he's in a high security prison where he is cut off from his family, from his friends. He's in an incredibly isolated situation on remand in relation to a completely unprecedented and abusive extradition request from the United States government. And I believe this case is political. It always has been political, and it requires a political resolution. We will, of course, continue to utilize whatever appeal mechanisms we have available to us as his legal team to be able to defend him and protect him from US extradition. But ultimately, this comes down, I think, to the politics of the situation. And really, this case should never have been started, and it ought to be for the Biden administration to close the case down for the grave threat that it poses, not just to Julian Assange, but to every single journalist and publisher in the United States.
Well, yeah, and here. And probably in Australia too, anywhere in the free world. Now, you've seen Julian this week. Can you just take us through how he is, and also how you have managed with all the confidential communications as his legal representative you have to have with him?
Julian's situation in prison, he's incredibly isolated. Through COVID, it was unbearable. He couldn't see his family, his children. We couldn't have in-person prison visits with him, so he was very isolated for a very long time. It made our preparations for his extradition case incredibly difficult because we couldn't. It was hard to see him. We had to have video calls. That was the only way we were able to speak to him. We couldn't see him securely in person. These have all been massive impediments to our ability to be able to properly defend this case. But it's also had an incredibly damaging effect on his mental health. Let's not forget, he's already spent 7.5 years inside a room in an embassy, and now he's in a high security prison. And for what? For Nobel Peace Prize nominated publications. It's dragged on so long, and I think people need to resist normalizing this situation and resist continually maintain the sense of outrage at the injustice that it is.
A political trial, Martin. It really is. It's like almost the political trial of the century so far, isn't it?
It is. Well, I met Julian's father at an event in Bristol not long ago. He compared it to the Dreyfus case in France in terms of its political importance.
Well, can you help make
the Dreyfus case was a case of a Jewish French army officer.
Artillery officer.
Yeah, who was wrongly accused. I can't remember what he was wrongly accused of. Cowardice or something.
I think spying for the Germans.
Spying for the Germans. Yeah. And it became a cause célèbre because it was the anti-Semitism in France which had led him to be blamed and so on.
I don't know if you remember last Christmas time-ish, we circulated the English version. Sound engineer Dave Bazanko did a fantastic job by remixing it with all the subtitles, English subtitles in, which was impossible thing to find. The Roman Polanski film about the Dreyfus affair, I think it's called An Officer and a Spy, which is a brilliant film, but it was banned in Britain for some reason. I think it was only shown in France. So this is an important political trial from history, and you're saying that you think Julian's trial...
John Shipson was saying that he saw it as that Julian's trial is as important as the Dreyfus case. And I said to him, it's far more important than the Dreyfus case, because the Dreyfus case was only about the high politics of one major power, France. What Julian's case is about, he's put on trial the whole of the Western system in Britain, the US, the warmongering establishment that controls our politics. It's all bound up in this case, which is one of the reasons why Balthazar Garzon, for example, the activist judge from Spain, is prosecuting the Spanish company which spied on Assange against for the CIA, against Spanish law. So he's chasing that one.
I mean,
it's
not
down.
Just a political trial, is it? It's a kind of gangster murder trial as well. Wasn't Pompeo actually talking
said, "Why don't we kill him?" Yeah. And in the film, Stella, his wife, Julian's wife, goes to the US as Trump is leaving power, because, as you may know, it's ridiculous, but every president leaving power can pardon 200 criminals. I don't know why. What it means is they can just pardon the people that have helped them out, get out of jail free for these people. But anyway, there was some suggestion that he might pardon Assange, Julian Assange, because, of course, Assange proved that it wasn't the Russians that hacked the DNC computers, which was actually sorted, that was in Trump's interests. They had somebody who was lobbying Trump on the behalf of Julian Assange. And he phones Stella, and he's talking to him on the phone. He says, "Well, I nearly got Donald to sign the pardon, but there are a lot of other people up there who just want him dead."
Well, that's true.
And Pompeo is on the record of saying, "Why don't we kill him?"
As I understand it, Trump would have pardoned Assange if Julian Assange had dobbed in his sources. And said, for example, he admitted to getting this material from Chelsea Manning. But
this material of the hacking of the DNC computers, the person who probably gave the material to WikiLeaks was Seth Rich, who ended up being murdered in a so-called robbery where his wallet wasn't even taken.
I suppose even if Julian is in jail, any kind of outfit operating like WikiLeaks, saying send us your stuff, we'll get it out there, is a target now.
Well, that's the whole point of it, isn't it? They're making an example.
I mean, that's what the journalists are supposed to do. That's what newspapers are supposed to do. You phone them up, you tell them things, and then they print it. But apparently that's not the case anymore.
Well, what they're trying to do is silence investigative journalism. I mean, in the past, Seymour Hersh, the very celebrated US investigative journalist, said, "Well, the things I used to do, they are trying to make sure that they can't happen." They're determined to prevent the truth coming out about all sorts of skullduggery in which they've been involved.
Yeah, right.
And that they, to do that, you've ultimately got to subvert the court system. And that's what they're doing, because they want to have, this whole conspiracy behind what's been going on in the West for decades by the intelligence services embedded with the oligarchy is criminal, including drug dealing, as we were discussing earlier.
Whether we call it the New World Order or the Deep State or the Anglo-Zionist Empire, whatever it is, it seems to be using surveillance and other things in order to shut down, destroy its critics. Now, back many years ago when I first started in journalism, journalists and lawyers, such as Jennifer Robinson and I, we were given a guarantee that there would be no surveillance on us without a court seeing it. But these what we've seen now, of course, is that we've got, you know, organisations like the National Security Agency, etc., that are spying on everybody and everything, and they're collecting vast amounts of information. So that if anything, say for example, something comes to court or whatever, they have got the whip hand. They've got all the information on you. And this is something that I asked Jennifer about, because quite clearly in this case, with all of this US intelligence might and Pentagon power, you know, trying to win this case here in London, you know, she may be under surveillance herself.
The revelations from Edward Snowden about the nature and extent of surveillance should cause concern, not just for journalists, but as I've been saying for many years, for all lawyers, because how can journalists protect the confidentiality of their sources if we're all being spied on all the time? How can we as lawyers protect the legal privilege if we can't necessarily protect against government surveillance? And in fact, I sued the British government and went to the European Court of Human Rights on the grounds that, and the court disagreed with us here in the UK, that it was reasonable to suspect that I was being spied upon, and the UK government agreed that my rights had been violated. This is really concerning, and it interferes with clients' ability to have a right of defence.
There have also been questions raised about the whole judicial procedures with specific judges even having links to the defence establishment in this country.
Yes, there was concern raised with one judge in particular in the earlier stages of the extradition proceedings, who an application for recusal was sought because of her connections through her husband to the intelligence establishment here. I mean, that's long, long gone history in this case now, but I do think a lot of people have been affected by the WikiLeaks disclosures. A lot of people in power, a lot of people within the establishment have been affected by them. But I think anyone with integrity and belief in democracy can stand back from it and say that this has the publications have been of immense public interest. They have shown us so much about government abuse, about corruption the world over, about human rights abuse. Just to give you one example, I remember I started working for Julian around the same time they published the WikiLeaks Iraq documents. And at the time, I'll always remember this quote. Julian said, "If lies can start this war, then the truth should be able to stop it." And I remember thinking it was a great line. And in retrospect, though, he was right. He turned out to be right. And the reason I say that is that WikiLeaks published the Iraq war logs, which showed, you know, a far higher civilian death count than had ever previously been reported by the United States government, evidence of torture within US prisons and Iraqi prisons, widespread human rights abuse, and same in the diplomatic cables, evidence of US war crimes in Iraq. As a result of those publications, the Iraqi parliament decided to withdraw the immunity agreement for US troops in Iraq. And so ultimately, those publications did contribute to the ending of the occupation of Iraq. So in the end, Julian, in a way, was right. And I think that's a really good example of showing how if we in a democracy don't know what's happening in the conflicts that we as taxpayers are funding, how can we make informed democratic choices about who we're voting for and why we're voting for them and why we're continuing in a war? And if we don't have access to that information, then how can we possibly make the right democratic choices? And I do think that these publications do have clearly have had a real world impact. One of the things that I found most satisfying of our last extradition hearing was the evidence that we were able to put before the court from a human rights lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, from Reprieve, a well-known British charity and a non-governmental organisation working on human rights, about the impact that the cables have had, for example, the Guantanamo Bay files, how that material showed, published by WikiLeaks, showed that these people were being held without good reason. Now, we all suspected that, but we didn't know it until we saw it on the page. And that was essential in the campaign in the US to close Guantanamo, which is now Biden's policy. And so it's ironic that the Biden administration is continuing to prosecute the publisher who released that information to allow the campaign to happen. Then if you look at the WikiLeaks disclosures about US drone strikes in Pakistan, the extrajudicial killing of Pakistani civilians, the result of the disclosures meant that there was campaigning in Pakistan and a huge campaign to put an end to those drone strikes. I can give you example after example. The WikiLeaks disclosures, I've used them personally in the Chagos Islands case before the International Court of Justice, where we cited the cables. They were cited in the Supreme Court here in the case brought by the Chagos Islanders before the British court, but we also cited them in the International Court of Justice in the case that showed that British occupation of those of the Chagos Islands is unlawful and they should be returned to Mauritius. Now, these are incredibly important documents and revelations that we have been able to put to use in courts around the world to hold governments to account. And people need to remember why this case is so important. I think people forget the importance of the publications, and I really encourage people to go back and look at the stories that have come out as a result of WikiLeaks and that historical archive that continues to sit there and can be mined for so long. I still believe there will be so many more stories in those cables that still haven't been reported, or cables that will come to light as the news cycle unfolds and politics develop in countries around the world, that will shine a new light on what's happening today. And that's an immense resource for the world.
In a way, what you're saying there, Martin, is in some ways WikiLeaks has already done its job in getting so much information about the way that the US, particularly through these things like these diplomatic cables, really works. And also it's had real world effects.
And that's why they're so mad. Because in actual fact, Julian Assange has done us a service and caused them an enormous amount of grief. And that's why Pompeo was saying we should treat this as a hostile non-state intelligence agency. And ultimately, of course, it isn't justifiable in any way, shape or form. As they say sometimes in this country, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. And of course, it's not Julian that should be in prison. It's a lot of people at the top in the US and in Britain.
Okay, how do you think this is all going to go, though? Because he's decided he wants to toughen out. He's going to fight all the way.
Well, he hasn't got much of an option, really, has he?
He has got an option, yeah. He can just say, right, OK, I'll get on a plane to America, do what you want with me.
Well, but when he gets to America, he's presumably going to be put on trial.
Well, he's going to be in jail, yes, but he's in jail now.
No, but he's going to be tried under these offences, these offences in America.
Yeah.
Well, I think what's probably...
You know, the Espionage Act, there's no record of anybody being accused under the Espionage Act of being acquitted at all.
Well, I know. So, in other words, what's in front of him is continuing to fight in this country, because the substantial part of the appeal is yet to be properly judicially looked into. And then even if he is extradited, there's then another political and legal fight in the US. Now, what we need to do as supporters of Julian Assange is make the price for the US government and the British government so high that they decide it's better to just chuck in the towel. Because in actual fact, if we mobilise a worldwide movement around this case, and people have put, as was suggested by Jennifer there, go back. They don't want us to talk about what was in the WikiLeaks cables. That's exactly what this is about. So we should talk about exactly what's in those cables, and we should publicise everything that's in the way that Jennifer just suggested. And the more we do that, and the more publicity we generate around that, eventually it will become in the interests of the establishment to find a way out from their own point of view, because it's just becoming an embarrassment. As Julian Dad pointed out, when the West meets with Putin and Russia, or Xi Jinping and China, the first thing they bring up on the agenda when human rights is mentioned. Yeah, and we want to bring up human rights with you, and they say, yes, what about Julian Assange? And of course, shows the significance of the case.
So the BBC haven't really covered very much of Julian's case. They do occasionally. They seem to have a kind of reluctance to do so, even to do with the wedding when Julian got married to Stella earlier this year. No TV coverage of it. There's something on the website, but it's not considered anywhere near important. The BBC, becoming more and more establishment by the day. Emily Maitlis this week at the Edinburgh Television Festival is referring to the Tory cronyism at the heart of the BBC. Now, we often get people referring to the BBC as a left-wing place, but, I mean, you know, obviously the Tories are not a left-wing party. In her keynote lecture at the Edinburgh TV Festival, former BBC journalist Emily Maitlis warns of the perils of fake news and the consequences when the agenda is hijacked by people in powerful positions. She says that she's criticised her former employer, claiming the board has been infiltrated by a Conservative Party agent and former Downing Street spin doctor, whom she claims is now an arbiter of BBC impartiality, delivering the McTaggart Memorial Lecture, which I remember back, gosh, was it early 1990s, mid-1990s, a brilliant McTaggart Lecture by Dennis Potter. Gosh, those were the days where he really laid into John Burt, who was at the time the Director General of the BBC, in a most entertaining fashion. Tory cronyism, she says, at the heart of the BBC. She spoke about her own perceived impartiality whilst working for the broadcaster. She was twice accused of showing bias against Boris Johnson. First, when she discussed the ex-chief advisor Dominic Cummings' lockdown trip to Barnard Castle, and second, after she retweeted Piers Morgan, who was questioning the government's response to the pandemic. Now, this whole idea that the BBC has got a line, it's not a political party, is it? The journalists don't have to have a specific point of view, otherwise they're disciplined.
Well, what the debate is all about, isn't it? That the Tory press regard the BBC as left wing because it isn't as rabidly right wing as they are, and of course the left regards the BBC as right wing because it's not as rabidly left wing as we might like to see, and things get suppressed and so on. And of course, what's actually happened with the Tory government are determined either to corral the BBC completely to make it more like the Tory press, or just to get rid of it. Nadine Dorries wants it to be gone, as does Rupert Murdoch, of course, for his own commercial reasons. I think, we can see what's happening. I mean, the whole debate, the BBC, because it is funded through the licence fee, is dependent upon the government of the day agreeing to renew the licence fee and agreeing what the level is. And therefore, they're able to exert power over the editorial of the BBC. Now, BBC journalists used to have all sorts of different opinions and they were allowed to express them. And, you might have a lefty panorama put on by somebody, like John Ware at one stage exposing Brigadier Gordon Kerr's involvement with the Loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland.
But then Martin Bashir interviewing Princess Diana about the adultery against her by Prince Charles.
And you've also got right-wing shows, like Jim Davidson on TV on Saturday night making what I would regard as off-colour jokes. These things, the BBC is a big institution and you should expect that there's going to be a variety of different views there.
Well, actually, that's what's changed, I think, isn't it? That the spectrum of different opinions, which are considered to be healthy in a democracy, is now being narrowed and narrowed.
That's right. And, of course, the pressure is for the BBC is supposed to give give everybody a fair go. But, of course, the news agenda is set by the Fleet Street Red Tops. And that then becomes what the BBC have to talk about. So just after austerity came in, the BBC organised a debate up at Filton College, and we all piled in there for this debate. But the framing of the debate was completely right-wing. They had a box full of cash, and they said, this is what every person in Britain owes, and what are we going to do to get the debt down? So, in other words, the whole debate has been framed in terms of the government would like, which is, how do we get the debt
down?
Well,
that's what the BBC
rather than, hang on a minute, what are the economic problems we face?
When this whole austerity thing started, we had a farcical thing by the BBC here in Bristol. Oh, gosh, it's called austerity. Let's explain it to the children. Mm. And, of course, much of what we see in our mainstream press is very much talking down to people. Whereas, of course, it's supposed to educate people. That is by talking up to you, by educating you. And what they said was, we are presenting this whole plan for government savings, not cuts, savings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was an audience participation event, which I participated in. And the whole framing of the debate was in terms that the tabloid press and the Conservative Party would have been happy with. So instead of asking, hang on a minute, why have we bailed the banks out? The question becomes, oh, we've got to cut public expenditure down, which is a secondary question altogether.
Well, they say things like, don't they, like, we've got to tighten our belt.
Yes.
We've got to batten down the hatches.
That's right.
But this is all just analogies, and there's no real analysis. Now, I'll tell you who does do analysis. That's WikiLeaks. That's people like Jennifer Robinson. I think it's fantastic to have the opportunity to interview her. for you this week. And I think also, just to remind you that I'll put the full version of that interview, which is half an hour or so long, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But one of Julian's biggest supporters in this country is this guy called Roger Waters, Martin, isn't he?
Yes, he is. And Roger Waters, incidentally, has been put on the, I think it's the Mekhravets website in the Ukraine. It's called Peacemaker website, where they basically put up the contact details and addresses of people who end up getting murdered in the Ukraine. Lots of people are murdered in the Ukraine by government-backed death squads.
So they're putting up names and addresses of people in other parts of the world that support
that's
Ukraine.
Right, that's right.
And is this not legal, and of course, surely?
Ukraine is now a post-legal state.
This is a kill list, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And Roger Waters has been put on it.
Well, anyway, let's have a hear from Roger Waters. What's he got to say?
Any war, when did it start? What you need to do is look at the history, and you can say, well, it started on this day. You could say it started in 2008. Okay? This war is basically about the action and reaction of NATO pushing right up to the Russian border, which they promised they wouldn't do when Gorbachev negotiated the withdral of the USSR from the whole of Eastern Europe.
Thank God
thank God the Russians had already won the war almost by then. Don't forget, 23 million Russians died protecting you and me menace.
Hey, and you would think the Russians would have learned their lesson from war and wouldn't have invaded Ukraine.
Well, you with all your reading, I would suggest to you, Michael, that you go away and read a bit more and then try and figure out what the United States would do if the Chinese were putting nuclear-armed missiles into Mexico and Canada.
I think, a brilliant perspective. And it's nice to have somebody like Roger Waters as one of Julian's big supporters, isn't it?
It is. And, of course, at one stage I thought Roger Waters had drunk the Kool-Aid about what was going on in the Ukraine, because I'm afraid there's quite a lot of people out there who really bought this nonsense about what's happened, because the war started really in 2014 with the coup and the massacre in the Maidan Square, which a court case in Kiev proved was carried out by NATO death squad led by an American officer. All of this is on the record and checkable, but most people think that this evil Putin, he's like Hitler, and he's invaded Ukraine and we must all freeze to death in order to stop him. It's just bonkers. I mean, it's going to take a while for people to see through this. I'm afraid military defeat is probably the only way they're going to recognise it.
Well, let's hope that they do at some point, and let's hope that there is some sort of... is there going to be no peace deals, Martin? It doesn't look like the Americans really want to have a peace deal. They're chucking everything at this, aren't they? And half of it may be going to the mafia, but they don't seem to care.
Well, since they are the mafia, of course they don't care. Don't forget there's all sorts of kickbacks involved with this, yeah? This is a massive, massive boondoggle for some people. And, of course, the British role in it all has been particularly pernicious. At any stage, when this round of fighting began, for the first time in 8 years, the Ukrainians agreed to negotiate with the Russians. And the Russians said, great, let's talk. So they started talking. They nearly had a deal. After the meeting in Istanbul, which Erdogan had brokered, there was a deal on the table that both sides were happy with. Do you know who went to Kiev to say don't accept this deal? Our glorious Prime Minister. Because, of course, he's got a vested interest in trying to make himself look like Churchill. But, of course, Churchill did actually fight in the First World War, unlike Boris Johnson, who's never heard a shot fired in anger and is basically a dilettante. But, of course, he's pushing, and lots of politicians in the West are vying with each other to push the Ukrainians to carry on fighting, whereas the obvious thing for them to do is to call for a ceasefire and negotiations, which will involve accepting that certain parts of the Ukraine have seceded, just like Kosovo seceded from Serbia. Incidentally, it's possible that that conflict is going to be restarted very soon, because the masters of chaos seem to want to have all sorts of conflicts going at the same time.
Well, with the assassination of Alexander Dugin's daughter, Daria Dugina this last weekend. We will be launching off in a minute in part two, looking at Ukraine, obviously. But before we do, what about the Tucker Carlson show? I know you don't like Fox News, Martin, but he's been putting some interesting things on there over the years. He's exposed Peter Daszak, the Wuhan lab, and that sort of thing. And I mean, it's one of those things with the press, isn't it? You know, they have a bias, but almost every single publication, from the Morning Star to Fox News, at some point or other, put out something which is brilliant and useful. And it's all a jigsaw puzzle. So anybody that says, oh, I never look at the Daily Mail or whatever, is just being stupid, because sometimes every publication will publish. Even the Oldie magazine was the where they published the Jimmy Savile story first, and from that day on, that Jimmy Savile story went all around the world. So every single publication is important, and that's why we need to have you know, people like WikiLeaks too, in order to make sure that stuff gets out there one way or another. Because if it doesn't, you get a criminal gang taking over the planet. And someone in that criminal gang, of course, is a man called Bill Gates. So certainly through his COVID stuff, and we'll be hearing after the break about that. But this is, I think, particularly fascinating little piece that Tucker Carlson did earlier this week about Bill Gates' latest project.
Bill Gates doesn't think of himself as some guy who got super rich making bad software. Bill Gates thinks of himself as God, in control of the solar system. And that's why Bill Gates is now backing something called sun-dimming technology that would reflect sunlight out of the Earth's atmosphere, causing global cooling. Ooh, that's not fraught with risks. You thought gain-of-function research on pathogens was dangerous. Try that. But that doesn't stop Harvard University. Its scientists are testing that technology by spewing calcium carbonate dust into the atmosphere.
Bill Gates is backing the first high-altitude experiment of one radical climate change solution, creating a massive chemical cloud that could cool the Earth. It's called solar geoengineering, and it's highly controversial. It would look something like this. Thousands of planes would fly very high and use nozzles to inject millions of tons of light-reflecting particles into the stratosphere. It would create a thin chemical cloud of those particles around the whole planet, blocking some sunlight from reaching the surface. It would mimic a giant volcanic eruption, which we know cools the Earth.
Now, just to restate, Bill Gates is not God. Bill Gates is some kind of weird, socially awkward rich guy who lives in Seattle. He doesn't own the planet, but he's now changing the planet single-handedly. This is not just over his yard in Seattle. This is over your yard and our oceans and the whole planet. Now, according to Forbes, Frank Kutch, who is the project's top investigator, quote, does not know what the results might bring. I'll just experiment with the globe and find out what happens. It's cool, though. He's a billionaire.
So there you go. This is actually not a new technology, Martin. Apparently, it's been around for a while, since before the pandemic. But Bill Gates wants to fund these solar geoengineering to stop global warming, as fires in the Amazon rainforest prompt renewed global outcry over climate change. Bill Gates is backing the first high-altitude experiment of one radical approach to help. It's called solar geoengineering, and it could create a massive chemical cloud around the whole planet, cooling the surface. It could eradicate blue sky completely and cause massive shifts in weather patterns that could cause famine and drought. It's also cheap, and the technology is not far off today. So this is the sort of thing that people like Gates seem to be wanting to put their money into.
Well, it's it's hubris followed by nemesis, isn't it? I mean, people, you know, it's not just him. Don't forget the military are also experimenting with all of these things. And
funny, because he did a little deal with the military when he was a little kiddie boy, didn't he? In wearing shorts, where they said to him, if you develop this Microsoft operating system, which we've got a backdoor into, and make sure it goes all around the world, we'll give you loads of money.
Yes, that's a summary, so but it's correct.
It wouldn't be the first time he'd been doing deals with the military, would it?
No, it wouldn't. And, these people are dangerous.
Is he a front for the military?
Yes.
DARPA?
This is where I probably differ from you. You see people like Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates as the actual evil doers.
Well, not necessarily. No, I don't.
They are actually.
We've had Alex Grainer on this show.
Lower down the food chain.
I think, yeah, well, that's exactly right. Yeah, I think it's largely the finance people who are further up the food chain than they are, because they're the ones that decide where the money goes. And this is one of the reasons I'm so... I've been pointing out a lot about Yuval Noah Harari recently, Martin, is because the fact that a lot of these people talk about him as the prophet means when he says there's a new industry in the making, suddenly money appears behind it. The finance people are backing people like Yuval Noah Harari and their vision for the future.
That's right. So you've got a complex of ideologues, financiers, and military intelligence.
Basically,
people.
It's a clique. you could say,
yes, it is. But that's ruling classes historically have always been organised in this kind of a way, you know. And there's a different balance of power within it between different groups looking for different outcomes. But the ordinary people, you know, there isn't really any democracy. It's a facade, and in some countries, it's not even a facade, is it?
Yeah, so just on climate, over the next few weeks, I'll be playing a couple of excerpts from this. It's an excellent interview on Truth Quest Radio. This is from 2009, this interview, but it says a lot about what's going on today. The guy being interviewed is, in fact, I think it's two academics, one interviewing the other, Christopher Horner and Dr. Elliot Karlstrom, talking about the pressure that's being, and this is, you know, like I say, in 2009, being put on academics to go along with the climate change and at the IPCC, which I thought was an absolutely fascinating interview. Like I say, I'll put a link up to the whole thing on our show page, but here's a little excerpt.
The UN, the World Meteorological Organization, created this intergovernmental panel on climate change. You've noted it's a UN body. As you know, the WMO also has UN affiliation, and they created it. It was expressly chartered, I believe, in 88, in the 1980s, to expressly chartered to support a future climate change agreement. I think they called it global warming at the time, but to support a potential future treaty. And so you're not going to get both sides out of this group. And this group claims it is, remember, it's an intergovernmental panel. And it represents scientists from around the world who turn out, they're touted as world's leading climate scientists, which means anthropology teaching assistants, for example, true story, transport policy instructors, instructors in the human invention of environmental change, and so on. But it's touted as world's leading climatologists and so on when there aren't 2,000 climatologists in the world. There are 80 PhD climatologists in America. And so they don't, trust me, they don't exist in Micronesia and Papua New Guinea where they don't have climate research budgets. But we have to derive a Noah's Ark of, quote, climate scientists to claim, look at our wonderful global project. So it's 2,500 participants. But it turns out they don't even write the document that's waved around as the product of 2,500. But both of you knew that because you could never write anything with 2,500 people. I mean, you've written something with a committee of 12 and it's a nightmare. So, here's what happens. It turns out the one document that's waved around as proof is on the first part. It's on the actual climate science. And it's written by 52 people. And I guess that's not impressive because they don't choose to sell it that way. They sell it as the product of 2,500, which is a lie. It's a flat-out, knowing, conscious lie. So they must think on its face it isn't that impressive. It's 52 people waved around as the product of over 2,500. It is reviewed, but we now know for the first time that this document is not peer-reviewed in any sense of the term because the peer reviews were ignored if they challenged it. Peer review, of course, means essentially you have to make the suggested change or explain why the change wasn't made. None of that's done. They simply ignored. And we know this because for the first time, thanks to a threat under the Freedom of Information Act, because the U.S. government's a party and they had the information, they released the comments of the reviewers and the responses to the comments for the first time in 2007 for this fourth assessment report. But just so we know how non-scientific this thing is, in the first assessment report, it showed 1,000 years of accumulated knowledge. It showed there was a medieval warming, there was a global cooling, then it warmed, though not nearly so warm as it was in the medieval warming, and that had been tapering off. It's a wonderful chart I use in every show I give. We know it's true because the UN told us it's 1,000 years of accumulated knowledge. It's represented in artwork. It's represented in science from around the world about the global changes from Tasmania to Costa Peru, to North America, to Europe, to Asia. There were global warmings, there were global coolings. Well, that's not going to work. So one UN lead author, Jonathan Overpeck from the University of Arizona, sent an email to another scientist named David Deming at the University of Oklahoma. After Deming wrote an article that this guy indicated showed that Deming was an alarmist, which he was not. And he said, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period in his email. Well, the next UN report did get rid of the medieval warm period, and it made the Little Ice Age 30 years long, which is completely betrayed by artwork from around the world and agricultural records, official documents, and so on. They rewrote history because they had to. And this David Deming at Oklahoma, by the way, when he reported this, was fired. And he was fired at the behest of a, as I write in Red Hot Lies, of a donor who said, this is not what I intended when I gave the school all this money. He hired this group called, he engaged a group called FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. He was reinstated to the university in a different college, given an office that was not in the basement, and given his classes back. But that just shows you the pressures that are on academics to make sure you toe a particular line, as I'm sure you may have experienced.
I think this is one of the most worrying things about the whole intergovernmental panel on climate change is if you start to challenge or question it. In fact, this is going on in the mainstream press as well. This is considered to be a difficult a problem. You just can lose your job. So that they've ended up creating a stable of scientists who all think the same thing.
Well, as you know, we debate these issues week in, week out on this show. Some people believe it's a fraud. Others do not. I'm agnostic. I think we've got to do things to improve our environment, which whether global warming is a thing or it isn't. Just think in terms of we used to talk before global warming of peak oil and resources running out. And that is an issue that we need to face. I think that something that suggests to me that global warming is happening is that the oil companies and countries which are surrounding the Arctic are planning all sorts of infrastructure to be built up there on the basis that it's going to be defrosting. They wouldn't be
well,
doing
maybe
that.
Maybe they're drilling for oil anyway, whether it's going to defrost or not.
The point is that because of the global warming, these areas are becoming available to be exploited. The Russians and the Chinese are planning to put in a huge, they're building icebreakers to carry goods from China around the north of Russia to Europe and to the United States. And they're building the infrastructure as we speak.
I don't think
because they believe that this is going to be viable.
Well, yes, there certainly is some climate change going on. But it seems to me that there's the problem at the heart of all of this, as I say week after week, is that the real problem is the massive industrial output of China and particularly fossil fuels being used in China. And we're not going to go to war with China to stop them, are we?
Well, listen, the argument about if we're going to accept that global warming exists, and I'm not saying I do, I'm just saying if you're going to accept that, then there's got to be some generationally and historically relevant redistribution of resources so that countries like China and Africa needs to industrialise. And when they industrialise, they're going to have to release carbon. Now, that means you've got to reduce carbon in other places.
Like China?
China is committed to doing stuff with the international...
You seem to be sort of just like a spokesman for the Chinese government.
The Chinese government will say, we are bringing our population out of poverty after hundreds of years of imperialist exploitation by countries like Britain.
But shouldn't they be doing it with wind power rather than coal?
They're trying to reduce their coal.
So they're not doing very well.
Because it's a big country, and they've got and they're industrialising. When we were industrialising,
we're not going to go to war with China to tell them you must stop using coal.
No, in actual fact, there are supposedly agreements about all of this where everybody's signed up to. But the Chinese, as a result of the visit of Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan, have withdrawn from all cooperation with the West on climate change.
I'm not sure they were entirely cooperating anyway. The last of these COP summits, the Chinese leadership didn't go, did they?
No.
They sent a delegation.
And the reason
they
didn't go is because they were fed up about other things going on.
If I was Chinese, I would be, you know, taking kind of your position, I suppose, I mean, looking at the West and saying, you're just doing this to have a go at us.
that, that obviously big industrializing countries in the developing world, including India and China, they're on the same page on this, is we need to industrialize. So we have got to be able to release carbon into the atmosphere. We're willing to try and do as low a carbon industrialization as possible, but we need to industrialize. Africa needs to industrialize.
Yeah, you now, said
if,
gonna, that.
If you're going to do that, then somebody has to pay
the
price.
The IMF are going to have to pay for it, aren't they?
Well, the only way to get global justice is for the core of the system, the Western powers, the people who, I mean, every individual United States citizen, on average, consumes a massive amount of world's resources compared to the average individual
Chinese.
Yeah,
but the manufacturing is going on in China a lot of the time, and all most of the emissions are in China. Look, the point of all of this, surely, is really to push everyone to say, well, hang on a minute, we're going to have a world government, and if without a world government, we can't sort this out. And that's a globalist agenda in itself.
Well, we're going to have some kind of global agreement, otherwise we're going to destroy ourselves in a nuclear war,
likely. You're saying the Chinese have just said no.
That's because we are not being very nice to the Chinese. The US is trying to wreck the Chinese economy. It looks like the bioweapon attack, which of course Tucker Carlson exposed. Jeffrey Sachs has picked up on that this week.
So Nancy Pelosi going to Taiwan is basically screwing up everything, all the hopes for climate change to be sorted out.
The real problem is going back to the Trump era, where basically they decided we've got to wreck the Chinese economy before they overtake the US economy. It's a zero sum game. And to my mind, it will be very clear.
Biden has been doubling down on all that.
Yes, because it's a bipartisan oligarchic project.
And it was always a big competition between the Chinese and the Americans, even Obama and before.
So, in other words, there's no possibility of some kind of agreed world government.
Just point the finger at Trump and say it's his fault.
No,
it's
been going on since the US intervened in the Chinese Civil War in the 1940s support the nationalists against the communists.
This discussion from 2009 absolutely fascinating. I'll put a full version of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, because a lot of it is describing by academics who at the time were warning about things that are happening now.
Yeah, we in California experienced one of Enron's dirty dealings, of course, back in the 2001 time, just before Enron went under, when they created an artificial gas shortage here, and our energy bills went up, 50, 100%, 200%. And this state, which had a $10 billion surplus prior to that, quickly got a $10 billion deficit. And so we should understand that manipulating the energy market can be very, very expensive and bad for us.
Let me tell you something else. It's also habitual. It's a tough habit to break. And I say this because you're on to something. I'm serious. If you look at...
No, I know.
I left Enron, and I was the crazy guy standing on the street corner in a pinwheel cap and a surgical mask, muttering about this evil company that everybody in town loved, Republican, Democrat, Clinton, Bush administrations, all loved them. And then the unpleasantness came. And then suddenly everybody wanted to talk to me. And in the Washington Post piece that ran, I think, on Christmas Day of 01, the reporter came, sat down. I told him about this company it was what they did. They were always scheming on how to make money off of nothing. And you've all gone to school. We've gone to school with these people. We've seen them. And he looked at me, tapped the pencil thoughtfully against his forehead, and said, so what you're saying is maybe they weren't that bad after all, because they were pushing global warming. I said, no, you aren't listening. This is what they do. This is a red flag. You should have seen this coming. When you look for this common among companies, which, by the way, happen to have a few things in common. People who are trying to make a fortune off of doing nothing and are willing to pay groups to scare you into this while they wait at the bottom of the slide with this enormous web sort of paraphrase a Far Side cartoon, might be crazy. If we pull this off, we'll eat like kings. Well, that says something about the company. It was true in Enron's case. That wasn't just a lucky shot. You look at Lehman, you look at BOA, you look at Calpine and their market manipulation. You've got companies who are attracted to this for a reason, and that reason is that it appeals to them, this idea of making money off of nothing, and that should be a red flag.
So that's Dr. Eric Karlstrom and Christopher Horner discussing there with a lady in between just briefly. But this is a talk from Truth Quest Radio, 21st of April 2009. Martin, it's fascinating actually to go back to these Enron days, because he's saying there, oh, this is this great company, Enron. Everyone loves them, all the different parties, all the shareholders love them. And suddenly it went poof, it's gone.
That's right. And of course, what it was the privatization of what were public utilities, and the financialization of, I mean, Enron's basically a financial shell company supposedly supplying energy. But of course, they're manipulating everything. And then they bought Wessex Water here, didn't they? And then, because Wessex Water just used to be a water company owned by the government, and then it was privatized, and then Enron took it over. I mean, these energy infrastructure companies and the banking system should be in the hands of the public.
But they're not. They're toys of the private equity firms.
Well, that's right. And the financialization of our economy is the problem that we're facing. And it leads to rentier behavior, where it's impossible to make and do and produce decent stuff because too much money has been sucked into these shell games.
Well, we're going back to Michael Hudson's talk, aren't we? Yeah. We played a month or so ago. What was his book again? Finance capitalism, industrial capitalism, or socialism?
Yeah.
The future for civilization, yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Anyway, and you can have a look at that up on my BitChute channel, because I did an edit of that. Which is, I think, a lot easier to listen to. It's about 50 minutes. It really explains how, actually, that's what Ukraine is about, Martin.
Well, everything's part of the same global struggle.
It's a clash of different ways of doing things, basically. No, we're not going to do things like that. We're doing things like this in Russia. No, you're not. You're going to do things like that. So anyway, let's have a listen to the final clip from Dr. Eric Karlstrom and Christopher Horner before the break.
I suppose I gave some advice on unrelated issues to Enron while I was practicing, but my firm represented Enron in other areas, and they came to me one day and asked me to be director of federal government relations. This was in the spring, almost exactly 12 years ago, of 1997, before there was a Kyoto Protocol. And it was essentially no interview job offer. I said, sure. It was first or second day. I walked into a meeting with a green pressure group in Enron's suite of offices just across the street from the White House called Natural Resources Defense Council. And, okay, that's fine. And the next day, I was, again, fairly naive. I'd been just practicing law for the most part, didn't quite understand a lot of the ways that Washington works, I suppose, and the history of something called rent-seeking, where companies seek to make their fortune off of governmental policy favors as opposed to competition and innovation. So I didn't understand Baptist and bootlegger coalitions, which is essentially two otherwise opposed groups getting together to advance a common agenda. So that's what Enron and Natural Resources Defense Council were doing. And the next day, I sat in for Ken Lay at a meeting of something called the Business Council for Sustainable. They've changed their name several times, but I think it's energy or environment. And on my left was the Union of Concerned Scientists, and my right was the American Gas Association, BP, Niagara Mohawk Power, and others. And I asked one of those companies' representatives, and this was all at a very high level. Again, I was sitting in for Kenny Boy, and this was essentially general counsel level. And what were we doing sitting around a table with people who wanted to put us out of business? And he laughed and said, well, they want to put coal out of business first, which is fine if you want to do it on the merits, but they were working together on this do what I want or everyone dies theory to get a treaty. That was my point, and I mean, apparently that was my number one priority, which I hadn't been told. So I sent an email, Houston, we've got a problem. They didn't like that. Strange and even bad things started happening in the office. And I left. And I've been working on the other side for the most part ever since. I was not a lawyer with Enron, so I can tell you about these things, but I am a lawyer now working against the Enron agenda, which is largely pushed by companies that picked at the carcass of Enron and took their assets and therefore their business plan, like GE, BP, which has their solar panel company. Enron had the world's largest wind company, and that was GE now, and big natural gas pipeline, which is broken up among many owners, Warren Buffett, GE, I think Kinder Morgan has some, but a lot of companies who have assets that would make them rich if they could get a carbon rationing scheme in place, and that's that was my introduction to the issue, and that explains to a lot of people who might be confused by this argument that's made that, well, how bad an idea can it be? Some of America's most successful companies are also pushing it too.
Dr. Eric Karlstrom there, talking to Christopher Horner on the Truth Quest radio interview, which I came across a few weeks ago. That was done on the 21st of April, 2009. These are games these guys are playing, and carbon is just a part of the game.
Well, that's right. We're really dealing with the machinations of a well-connected elite to dominate. You know, they've decided that they are going to be the green agenda. And of course, that's got nothing to do with a genuine green agenda. It's just to do with their machinations.
Yeah, their plans to reshape the energy markets. Actually, what you know, this is one of the things I love about you, Martin. Is you're always banging on about we don't need to use so much energy. Quite correct, we don't. Certainly, you know, when I was growing up, you know, there were buses around, trains around. Not everyone had to have a car. There were about two or three cars in our street. Now, what they've done is certainly to begin with, made cars and fuel cheap, so everyone buys them. Take away the alternatives, the publicly resourced alternatives, and now they're saying, "Oh well, no, sorry, you know, you're going to have to charge more for this. You're going to have to pay more for this," and jacking up the prices of everything. So this is a racket, actually, isn't it? It really is a racket, and I found that fascinating. So I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at this week. .org.uk for your delectation later, and instruction, because this whole zero carbon, we'll just wind up with this, Martin, this whole zero carbon thing, carbon offsetting, is becoming almost like a religion. It's now what you've got to do. If you want to actually produce anything, somebody somewhere will look at what you're doing and say, well, hang on, you've got to pay X, Y, and Z because you're emitting carbon here.
Yeah, so I'm not in favour of carbon trading at all. And I think this is very significant. When I was working in the NGO sector, they were beginning to start to talk about this carbon trading. And to their credit, Greenpeace, Oxfam, War on Want, all of the main NGOs said we're not interested in this.
What about the New Economics Foundation?
They weren't interested in it either. Mm. And, of course, it's pushed by them. Well, this is a market solution to the problem of global warming.
Well, I mean, I remember all
there is no market solution to the problem of global warming.
I remember
if you're going
Mayer,
to have a plan, you have a plan. You don't have carbon offsetting and people pretending to have a market in it. That's rubbish.
I remember this mega enthusiastic violinist, Aubrey Mayer, pushing all this stuff up at the 2000, it was a summit up in Birmingham. Crikey, yeah. What was it? And they surrounded the summit.
The
G8. That's right. And we surrounded the summit. All we're holding hands in Birmingham all the way around saying,
well,
come on,
do something. That was mostly to do with the debts of the developing countries.
That's right. They was Jubilee 2000 were there, were saying, look, we've just got to forgive the debts. But the thing is that they were saying, here is a new economic system, and that is the system they seem to be rolling out today. Anyway. That is, like I say, I'll put a link up to that longer interview, which is a great, I think, fascinating insight into how this whole thing got going in the noughties, particularly there, and through groups like Enron deciding that they are going to change the energy market to their own advantage. I mean, actually, before we go, Martin, there's a background to all of this, isn't there? Say coal, for example. Coal, Britain's got loads and loads of coal. Somebody a long time ago decided, you know, that coal was the way to go because we've got so much of it. It's never going to run out, at least that's what they said. Then we were told by people like Ian McGregor and Margaret Thatcher, coal's got to go. We got rid of the coal industry. Then we're getting rid of the oil industry. But the oil industry is not something which we've got lots of necessarily, we can get access to. If there is a Middle East war, and I know you're always warmongering, not warmongering, going on about the war possibly happening, we won't be able to get at that oil anymore, will we? So it may be that all that's happening here is it's being restructured so that if there is a war, we've still got plenty of energy.
Well, we did have North Sea oil, but of course we wasted that. We handed it over to the US multinationals and they took the profit from it. In Norway, that profit was taken by the Norwegian government, which is why they've got one of the most successful sovereign wealth funds in the world. We haven't got anything like that. Because we just handed it over to the Yanks.
And we're running into an energy crisis with nuclear. We've got this Hinkley C supposed to be switched on last month, maybe even before that. But that doesn't look as if it could. Let me be absolutely frank with you. I don't think that that nuclear power station will ever be switched on. We're now looking at 2029. The model that it's based on is this this one at Taishan in China, which about I think it was about 10 months after it was switched on a couple of years ago, they had to switch it off because they had problems with the core, and they haven't been able to switch it back on again, Martin. This is the same design as the building down in Hinkley. So how, number one, are they going to get into the Taishan reactor, which is highly radioactive, and fix it? And number two, how are they going to redesign Hinkley C in midstream in order to make sure that that one actually works when they switch it on? And in the background to all of this, Macron's just announced that they're stopping winding down doing nuclear power over in France too. So all our eggs are in this nuclear basket, which is actually rubbish.
Yes, it's a white elephant. And of course, it's of no use whatsoever this winter to fantasise about
the next few nuclear
power, either, which will arrive in 10 years' time.
Even if you keep your fingers crossed, it's still not going to be in use for many winters. Anyway, this is, I think, the backdrop against which people in this country are going to be being told in the next few months and over Christmas, well, we're very sorry, but we're going to have power cuts. So maybe we should get those coal-fired power stations, or at least, at the very, very least, keep them in abeyance so that we can switch them on when we need them.
Lord, we praise you and we thank you. We ask that we may be willing disciples ready to respond and desiring to serve you because your ways bring fulfillment and true peace. For U.S. Bishop Robert Barron reflects that whenever a young person asks him how they can be happy, he replies, "If you want to be happy, do an act of love. By doing that, you are uniting yourself to the creator of the universe, who everything flows from in love and is created in love." Another way to put it, if God's love is like living waters, how connected and united do you want to be with his love? paddling in a small stream or immersed in the ocean of his love. Happiness awaits us when we respond with acts of faith, acts of love. Why? Because we were made for love, to be loved and to love. But the question is, how much love do you want? God offers love that is eternal, everlasting, out of this world, divine love. If you love people, you will change them. If you love them with divine love, you will transform them.
What is your opinion? A man had two sons. He went and said to the first, "My boy, go and work in the vineyard today." He answered, "I will not." But afterwards thought better of it and went. The man then went and said the same thing to the second, who answered, "Certainly, sir," but did not go. Which of the two did the father's will? They said, "The first." Jesus said to them, "In truth, I tell you, tax collectors and prostitutes are making their way into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you, showing the way of uprightness. But you did not believe him, and yet the tax collectors and prostitutes did. Even after seeing that, you refused to think better of it and believe him."
For reluctant son, of a son of good intentions who does not follow through with the father's request, can be recognised in holy women and men down the centuries, battling against their own weaknesses and flaws, understanding that seeking God's will in our lives can be hard and might not always seem attractive. St. Thérèse of Lisieux, the 20th century French nun, used to stand in a spot, look around her and say, "What does love demand of me right now?" and then do it. According to her diary, it was not always easy when God's will conflicted with her own selfish desires and struggles. But by surrendering to God and relying on his strength through prayer, she was given the ability to do God's will. And in doing so, her heart expanded in love of him and her neighbour.
Yeah.
Sabrina Johnson there with Peace. Before that, it was Father Frankie Mulgrove from Tuesday's Daily Service on Radio 4, which, by the way, is a bit awkward to get hold of these days. Of course, they make it awkward, don't they? So you can get it on digital, you can get it on DAB+. But you have to set... I've got an alarm clock that I set to 9:45, and to come on specifically when there's that channel basically pops up on digital at 16:10, and then it switches off at 10. And so you've got to be pretty sharp to catch the Daily Service on digital. Of course, it's always still there on good old long wave, and that's where, of course, it always was there traditionally. But anyway, so thanks very much to Father Frankie Mulgrove and also to Sabrina Johnson. Now it's back to Not the BCFM Politics Show for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner. And we're on the new talkradio.org.uk stream. Well, it's not really a new stream. It's just a new name for it. It's an easy place to find it. Talkradio.org.uk is where you go. That's where the stream is. And we are Not the BCFM Politics Show app. You can get this live too, as well as the show tonight, as well as all the extra downloads, including Julian Assange's, Jen Roberts, Julian's barrister. Available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google, that app. So anyway, welcome back to our programme with me, Tony Gosling, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, Ukraine, any more developments this week, particularly before we get stuck into this assassination?
Well, there's obviously the disinformation that's flying around about what's happening at this nuclear power plant, where the Ukrainians are shelling the nuclear power plant. And the Russians are saying, don't do that. And the Western media narrative was that the Russians were shelling their own nuclear power plant to make it look as if it was the Ukrainians. Can you see how this false flag thing is now becoming normalized as a thing that people can discuss? But then the Ukrainians changed the story, which is that they are shooting at the plant because the Russians have got heavy weaponry in there and they're using it as a nuclear shield for their weaponry. The plant is actually one of the biggest in Europe. Despite the fact that it's controlled by the Russians, it continues to supply electricity to the Ukraine. So this really is a special military operation, not a war. Yeah, you don't do that in a war. You just cut off their electricity. They're trying not to freeze people. And of course, the Ukrainians then sell that energy on to the Europeans. So,
and a profit.
Well, yes. And of course, the Naftogaz, which is the Ukrainian national gas company, they get their oil, their gas from Gazprom, and then they sell it on, they get it cut, and then they sell it on to other countries. I suppose once it's reached the Ukraine, it's no longer Russian, and therefore it's okay to buy it, even though that's where it comes from. So, the narrative surrounding what's going on in Ukraine continues to get crazier and crazier from the Western side. I follow the Moon of Alabama website, where they've got lots of very informed posters on there. It's absolutely bonkers. Most people have been completely deluded by what's going on, and their understanding of it is minimal.
Now, it's Daria Dugin that was assassinated, rather a nasty, fiery car bomb. That looks also as if the person who was behind the assassination, the Russians have now traced back to have been coming into the country from Ukraine and then pressing the button and living in the same place as Daria, some sort of tower block in Russia. And so anyway, what do we know about why Alexander Dugin's daughter was assassinated? I think they were trying, the Ukrainians or whoever's behind it, were trying to get him, maybe, weren't they?
Well, they're either trying to get him, or she is actually a kind of quite high-value target in her own right.
Well, she's a journalist. This is important. That I noticed this, and I tweeted out this earlier in the week, that the BBC, in their initial article, I think it was on Monday, I saw on Tuesday, oh, gosh, the article's changed. The first paragraph is suddenly omitting the fact that she's a journalist. Now, what on earth do the BBC think they're doing, covering up for the fact that this woman who's been assassinated in Russia is a journalist?
Well, I think that they had to report it in the West, But of course, and Kiev, of course, denies any involvement. But the FSB, the Russian security police, saying they've got, you know, a suspect, and they've been given a picture of her and so on, and CCTV footage of her.
Why would Dugin, or might Dugin, be of interest?
Because Dugin is being presented in the Western media as Putin's brain, as an advisor to Putin. That is simply an exaggeration, a massive exaggeration. Dugin is a philosopher. He's an academic philosopher, and he's got some, you know, he's got some views of his own, which are not reflected in the views of the Kremlin. So, for example, he was at one stage advising the Kremlin, but when the Minsk agreements were in place, the government didn't particularly want to talk to Dugin because they wanted a political solution, and Dugin was one of those banging the drum for war. So he was actually kept at arm's length by the United Russia government. But, of course, he's presented in the West as this evil Svengali. So we're presented with what is essentially a kind of pantomime theatre of evil, and therefore a legitimate person for the patriotic Ukrainians to kill.
But he's a funny-looking guy, and he looks like a kind of Rasputin character.
Well, look, that's what traditional Russian men were supposed to look like. Just like in Islam, if you are an Orthodox man, you're not supposed to cut your beard. Just like Rastafarians don't cut their hair. That's why they all look like that. It's part of the image of being a Russian Orthodox faithful person.
Anyway, I spoke to the author David Livingston in Canada earlier this week about Dugin. It's also worth noting, I mean, I'd be definitely want to run this one past you, Martin. I came across a tweet from a Lebanese journalist saying that Dugin had been involved in the closing down of the Russian Cultural Centre, sorry, the Jewish Cultural Centre, and there's legal moves to do that at the moment going on through August in Moscow. Now, the Israelis rely on this massively for bringing new Jews down from Russia into Israel, and it's a sort of pipeline of new people to put in settlements, etc., and that Dugin was one of the people possibly involved in suggesting that this place be closed down.
Yes, and it may well be that the Ukrainians, who may be the perpetrators of this, may be working with the Israelis because they've got an interest in stirring the pot.
Oh, you know
what?
It's not just stirring the pot. It's very, I mean, this is what the Middle East Eye article, which I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, details, is that there's been a war of words at the beginning of August between the new Israeli Prime Minister and the Russians. And with the Russians saying, hang on a minute, you know, some of these people are coming, you know, going down to Israel from Russia. They're then getting Israeli passports. They're going over to Ukraine and they're killing our soldiers in Ukraine.
That's right. Well, I mean, you saw the Israelis at first were unwilling to condemn the Russian intervention in Ukraine, but they're now lining up very much with the West. You said Yuval Noah Hariri, we heard him the other week, coming out with the usual boilerplate about, the Russians are just naturally imperialistic and so on and so forth. It's obviously a foul act, an illegal act. But at the same time, this is what the Ukrainian state has been reduced to. They're losing on the battlefield hundreds of soldiers every day. They've admitted that. They're never going to win on the ground, so they're now going in for terrorist attacks inside Russia, inside Crimea.
Yeah, and the BBC
and to up the ante and to try and get the Russians to overreact get a NATO intervention to support.
Of journalists, of people with specific opinions, and the BBC are covering their backside for them.
Well, I think it's just an embarrassment for the mainstream Western press, because in actual fact it's pretty clear it's probably the Ukrainians who carried out this act. Is it a justified act of war? No, it isn't.
No, anyway, so let's have a listen now to David Livingston. He's the author of Ordo Ab Chao, which does a lot of looking at these kind of figures like Dugin behind the scenes in Moscow. And I asked him what he thought of Dugin's daughter being assassinated this week.
There's several people who have been, key figures in modern occultism. So in the mid-1800s, you'd have Edward Bulwer Lytton, and after that, you had people like Aleister Crowley in the 20th century. And You know, I think 50 years from now, people who will be studying the history of occultism will be studying Alexander Dugin as being one of the leading figures. So he's really he's considered a representative of, you know, the history of what's called traditionalism. And that's one academic way of looking at it. But more specifically, it's Cynarchism. And Cynarchism begins with Saint-Yves d'Alvèdre, who was connected to the families, the Russian families associated with the descendants of Karl of Hessen-Kessel, who I said, as I mentioned, was the Grand Master of the Asiatic Brethren. And so Cynarchism was one of the most important cult traditions of modern times, side by side with Theosophy. And it's basically Cynarchism, particularly as a branch that has developed in France, you know, the particularly during, I think one would have been in the 30s, the Cynarchist movement was spearheaded by a guy named Jean Coutreau, who was working with Aldous Huxley. And the movement, so basically the movement was eventually exposed and caused quite a scandal. So, you know, there's suggestions that the movement didn't survive. But this Cynarchist movement was very closely tied with the development of the myth of the Priory of Zion. Particularly, they were close with the AMARC, which is the American Rosicrucian tradition, and the what's called the Polaire Brotherhood. So the Polaire Brotherhood was really interested. One of the people who was connected to it was Otto Kahn. He was the guy who, Otto Rahn. Otto Rahn, who popularized the sort of the Nazi version of the Holy Grail, sort of inspired, you know, one of Spielberg's Temple of Doom, I think is what it was. And so this Polaire Brotherhood is basically, you know, the Nazis were very committed, of course, to trying to find their Aryan heritage in Tibet. And there was a simultaneous stream that was happening in Russia at the time. A lot of occultists, again, associated with the Rosicrucian tradition, because this goes back to a conspiracy, basically a hotbed of conspirators involved in St. Petersburg at the turn of the century, who were looking to Nicholas II as being the White Tsar of Shambhala. And this connected all the key occultists of the time, who again were located. This would have included, according to Richard Spencer, would have included Aleister Crowley. And so this Polaire Brotherhood, which is supposedly oracle located in Shambhala, who were basically the nine knights, founding knights Templar, who were looking at Shambhala, or more specifically Agartha. So that's too much occult legend to explain, but just to say that this sort of Russian tradition, Cynarchist tradition, is really where Dugin comes from, and his entire political philosophy is founded on it. So he's created what he calls a conspirology, which is this mythology that the Russia and the East represents Hyperborea, and United States, NATO, and Britain represent Atlantis. Now, he believes that the true conspiracy is not a Jewish conspiracy, but a long-term occult conspiracy between these two blocks. And he effectively believes that the end times, because this is what he's trying to do, he's trying to bring about the end times, or the Endkampf, as he likes to call it, basically using the Nazi terminology, and which is going to pit Atlantis against Hyperborea. So the Polaire tradition, he believes, which survives in Russia through the creation of a Eurasian Union to offset or combat the Atlantean bloc of the United States and NATO. And that basically is where he... So basically, he is contributing to a mirror image of the conservative, neoconservative clash of civilizations. And that explains all of his activity. So this is why he has been working to create this Eurasian network, which is to unite Russia with the central states of Central Asia. against the United States, his work to undermine NATO, and most importantly, his orchestration of the Russian campaign to help Trump get elected.
Well, my very next question to David is, well, the Americans have actually done that, not Alexander Dugin, brought the Russians and the Chinese together, Martin.
Well, yes. And I think he's overestimating what the power of Dugin is. Dugin is basically a talker. He's not part of the Russian government. The Russians are indeed trying to build a Eurasian bloc in alliance with the Chinese. And the people in charge of that are people like Lavrov and Dimitrov, who are in the foreign service.
I mean, how close is Dugin to Putin?
Putin. He's never met him. This is what's so ridiculous about the West. What the stuff I've been reading suggests that the media in the West, they want to have somebody, you know, that Putin's an evil guy and he's got these evil advisors.
He's creating a sort of agenda of, oh, Putin's surrounded by all these weirdos, isn't it? And they're telling him what to do.
That's right, which is absurd. But he can't. I doubt whether Putin's obviously sent a message of condolence to Dugin about the assassination of his daughter. And he's saying, you know, she demonstrates what modern Russian patriots look like.
But there is something going on, isn't there? This Asian bloc, the Hyperboreans.
Yes, well, it's not Hyperborean. It's an obvious thing, isn't it? It's the heartland theory of Mackinder, which is that the thalassocratic sea-based powers which dominated the world since Sir Francis Drake sailed around it and then robbed the whole world and created the British Empire, followed by the it's actually Portuguese, Spanish, Dutch, British, American Empire, yeah?
Well, Drake only sailed around it because he was running away, didn't he?
Well, but the point is that the Eurasian powers, Mackinder, who's a British geographer, was saying, you know, who controls the heartland controls Europe, who controls Europe controls the world. And of course, it makes perfect logical sense. You don't have to have an occult philosophy for a big country like China to work closely with another big country like Russia. They've got complementary resources and populations and so on. Of course, they're going to cooperate to try and get richer. And of course, they're going to try and keep the West out because both countries have had a very bad experience of dealing with the West.
It's totally valid to look at these occult agendas because what's happening is, it seems to me, is in the modern era, some of them are becoming kind of exposed, and large countries like Russia or maybe China too are just breaking away from it. They're saying, well, we're not doing this. We're actually, because the idea is that the agenda is pushing everybody towards a bigger and bigger wars. And so some countries are saying, well, no, sorry, we're not having any of that.
Well, I don't see why you need to bring any occult explanation into
Dugin. Well, like, Dugin is into all this stuff.
No, well, Dugin is a marginal figure in Russia. Yeah, he's got his own.
You're saying that really that he's been assassinated in order to make this thing appear to be more important than it really is.
I think what you've got here is the Ukrainians are being advised by their Western psychological warfare SAS guys, undoubtedly involved in all of this, is we're going to carry out attacks behind enemy lines. We're going to blow things up in the Crimea. We're going to assassinate people. And of course, this is, don't forget, it was probably the British who were involved in the assassinations of Givi and Motorola, who were military figures, and Zakarchenko, who was the elected head, prime minister of the Donetsk People's Republic, blown up in a car bomb, just like this car bomb. And that was carried out by the Ukrainian SBU. They openly basically boast about it, and that will have been done with the advice and support of British special forces. So we, our people, are implicated in all of this. And it may well be that the Russians will be able to show that the handlers for this woman who pressed the button are, in fact, inside British intelligence, because that's the sort of thing they do. They blow up 30-year-old women journalists.
So why, the question is, this is published on the 9th of August, did Moscow shut down the Jewish Agency office? That's what it's called. It's not a cultural, as I said earlier. The Jewish Agency office in Moscow.
Because the relations between the Russians and the Israelis are deteriorating. Putin has always taken the view that he wants to have a balanced relationship with the Israelis. He doesn't, you know, he's reassured them that as long as they behave themselves, he's not going to undermine their national interests and so on. But that has changed.
It is changing. It's changing this month as the Tory leadership thing unfolds.
If you're going to go to war with us, we're not going to make your life easy.
Yes.
We're going to make your
the
life
Russian
difficult.
Ministry of Justice has applied to a court to shut down the Moscow office of the Jewish Agency for Immigration at a time when Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid warned that doing so would be a dangerous measure. So he's threatening a dangerous measure that would affect relations between the two countries. The agency was established in 1929 and began its activities in Russia in 1989, helping Jews to migrate to occupied Palestine. On the 15th of July, the ministry filed a complaint against the agency before a court in Moscow. So this is now chugging through the courts. The Russians are now shutting this down. The reason for Russia shutting down the Jewish agency may be the fact that when he was foreign minister, Lapid condemned the Russian war in Ukraine and Israel sided with the United States. He also accused Russia of committing war crimes. Russia has then discovered that several hundred volunteers holding Israeli citizenship were fighting in Ukraine against Russian troops.
Well, that's right. I mean, Putin is quite clever, and Lavrov and the others are quite clever. You know, they always talk to everybody. You know, there's no point not talking to people, would be their philosophy. But on the other hand, relations between the Israelis and the Russians are deteriorating. So you could see a situation. I mean, the Russians have basically said, if the Syrians decide to retake the Golan Heights, which is part of Syria, then we will, you know, we might support them politically. I mean, we might even support them militarily.
This is massive, isn't it? Because the supply of Jews from Russia and the old Soviet Union over the years has been a lifeblood of Israel.
It has. And, of course, there's a substantial section of the Israeli population who are actually born in Russia and are Russian-speaking. And, of course, the Russian mafia, which many of them are, in fact, ethnically Jewish, not all of them, but a great deal of them. Semyon Mogilevich, for example, the reputed head of the Russian mafia, is Jewish. Most of the oligarchs in Russia and Ukraine were Jewish. And that many of them have dual Israeli, Ukrainian or Israeli-Russian citizenship,
yes,
which allows them, of course, to operate. You know, lots of dirty money from Russia ends up in Israel and Cyprus and so on.
Does.
And I'm sure that the Russian authorities are very well aware of all of this.
Viktor Pinchuk have dual Ukrainian-Israeli citizenship. The oligarch who was organising the coup back in 2014 on the ground, telling the Berkut riot police where to stand and when to run away, when to fire, when not to fire, all that sort of thing, as we heard. Mm. And Pinchuk, you know, very important figure, major property owner in central London on Trafalgar Square as well. We never hear about these characters commenting on the closure of the agency's office in Moscow. Well, it does sound from this article, Martin, that the Middle East Monitor, that it is closed, this office now. The Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid said the Jewish community in Russia is deeply connected with Israel. Its importance arises in every diplomatic discussion with the Russian leadership. It's important from Israel's point of view to keep the flow of Russian Jews going to the occupation state, which needs more Jews to migrate to benefit Israel in terms of demographic conflict with the Palestinian people on the one hand, whilst also benefiting from their scientific and academic expertise on the other. So this is megally important for Israel, and they've said that here, or the Prime Minister has said that here quite clearly back on the 9th of August.
Well, you can understand from a Palestinian point of view, saying we're living in refugee camps in Syria and Jordan, we've got no status at all, we've got no passports whatsoever, we want to go home, but these people who've never lived in Israel can just walk in and take over the property that we used to own. And of course, the State of Israel was only created in 1948 because the Russians agreed to the creation of it, as did the Americans. The British position was that it shouldn't be created, but we were basically pushed out.
It's a bit difficult because of the languages here in Lebanese and Hebrew, etc. A lot of this is being discussed. But one Lebanese journalist called Nasser Kandil, I'll put a link up to his tweet up on the our show page at thisweek.org.uk, has said that Russian media sources are saying the fingers of accusation in the assassination of the daughter of the Russian thinker Alexander Dugin are heading towards the Israeli Mossad. After the Israelis accused Dugin of being behind the decision to ban the Jewish agency in Russia, and after his repeated calls for Russian leadership to take decisive positions on the Israeli raids in Syria too.
That's right. And of course, don't forget there is there are oligarchs in Russia itself of Jewish origin with Israeli citizenship who are quite hostile to the current Russian government, and they possibly provided networks through which this deed was accomplished. I don't believe it was a single person who did it. I think the named person that the FSB have named and are presumably asking to be extradited will have operated as part of a much bigger team. Well, when these things are never usually carried out by one person.
Well, don't hold your breath for that extradition. Anyway, let's move on now to... we have a pretty good discussion about the potential reasons for, and also, of course, the connections of Dugan. Who is this guy? And whether or not he's actually really of significance. It seems to me he's somebody that's listened to, his daughter is listened to, but the idea that they've got the ear of Putin seems complete nonsense. But it may be that what they're saying is just in parallel to what the Russian government is doing these days, and they don't have
those views are widely shared in Russia.
In fact, they were in Ukraine, weren't they? They were saying for between 2014 and the 2023 February invasion by Russia of the Donbass and surrounding areas and the special military operation, that many people in Russia, probably more than half the Russian population, were saying, come on, go and defend those Russian-speaking people in the Donbass. And Putin was saying no.
Well, that's right, because at that stage he was trying to make a last attempt to settle it politically. And, of course, people like Dugin have been saying all along, it's a waste of time, don't talk to them. And
well,
of course,
so have we, to be fair.
Well, no, I haven't been saying... I think the Russian Foreign Affairs...
The US is not deal ready, maybe? Things like
the
that?
The Russian Foreign Affairs strategy has not been to escalate unless you've got no choice. And it's what Alexander Raevsky, the Saker, calls the sixth column in Russia, is people who are demanding that the government, you know, go. They're saying it's time to take the gloves off. Why don't we kill? I mean, Dugin himself said, I do not want the Russian state to retaliate for this. What I want to see is victory in the war in Ukraine.
This is the interesting thing about all of this, isn't it? That this is something which the West would have found, if it had happened to them, rather horrific. You know, one of their mates in their clique had been taken out like this, and they would have probably gone crazy. The thing is, the Russians are a bit more cool customers.
Yes, well, unfortunately, Margarita Semenov, whatever her name is, who's the head of RT, she was saying in an off-the-cuff way, well, maybe we need to send some people to look at the... Because as far as they knew, this woman was now in Tallinn in Estonia. Maybe we need to see some people to look at the famous spires of Tallinn. In other words, a reference to the Borisov...
So send FSB people or whatever over to nab the assassin.
Yeah. But, of course, what was spun in The Guardian was that she was admitting that the Russians had carried out the assassination of Skripal. Although, of course, that can't be true because the hospital in Salisbury wrote to the Times the next week saying nobody has been poisoned with nerve agents in this hospital.
Martin, you've reminded me of a Twitter exchange I had this week with Diliana Gatasheva and some tweets she was doing with Kees van der Peel. Where she is saying that the evidence is now that she's got the evidence that the real reason for the two FSB guys being in Salisbury was because that Skripal wanted to come back to Russia, and that this is absolutely in Bulgaria and other parts of the world. This is becoming well known now that Skripal was someone who'd had enough of the UK, wanted to come back, and the two guys were there to try and make contact with him through some sort of secret method in order to arrange or make some arrangements to see if he could get out of the UK. And it's funny, isn't it, that we haven't heard anything from Skripal since, nor his daughter Yulia.
Well, we've been told that they've been spirit because they've probably been killed.
I mean, they've become a problem, haven't they? If you're a spy that's over in the UK from Russia,
no person,
and then
no problem.
You've suddenly decided, actually, I don't really want to stay in the UK. I'd much rather go back to Russia now. Suddenly, the Brits are going to, MI6 are going to look at you and say, "Well, of course, you can't go back to Russia."
The whole thing was timed to mess up the World Cup in Russia. You know, that's why it happened just when it happened, and the whole situation, I mean, that's what I was going to mention, is the murder of Berezovsky in Surrey. He supposedly strangled himself. And Berezovsky, of course, was an associate.
I think we should so advise any Russian people thinking of coming to get shelter from MI6, but I think again. Anyway, look, we're going to move on now to look at this fascinating talk that Greg Felton did for the Holding the Line journalists group, which they asked me to chair very kindly. And here he is talking about Ukraine. I think he's pinned it, Martin. He's pinned the whole Ukraine thing to Israel. We had him on about three or four months ago talking about this when it first occurred to him, that he thinks that, I mean, maybe before we hear from him, you can hear what you think about the links to Israel, because he's saying that he thinks maybe the fact that the Russians have intervened down in Syria to save Assad has annoyed the Israelis so much that they are egging on the Americans to open up a second front in Ukraine against Russia.
Well, I'm pretty certain the Israelis are aligned with the Anglo Empire, and of course they've got their own interests within that. So, for example, they might have assassinated this woman in order to try and provoke further conflict between Ukraine and between the West and Russia. But I don't see, you know, the Israelis punch way above their weight, but they are not the only bad people out there.
Okay, so we'll have to listen to Greg Felton now talking. I mean, he talks in the, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, about what I call here the controller virus, which is coronavirus, the deep state muscle flexing, COVID, Ukraine and international relations was the talk. But here he talks about Ukraine and Israel.
The United States really is not interested in Ukrainian democracy, which doesn't exist. It is not interested in helping the poorer Ukrainian people. Ukraine is irrelevant to this entire debacle. The actual shooting war is a sideshow. The only thing that is going on here is a calculated policy of weakening and ostracizing Russia. Not because it poses a great threat to anybody, but because there are people in the American government, the same people who brought you the World Trade Center implosion, the Iraq invasion, and countless other acts of aggression. These people want a unipolar world with the United States as the world hegemon. Russia represents a threat to absolute American power, as does China. Russia is also generally not liked by Israel, because Russia has in the past supported Syria and Iran and other Arab countries against Israel-American aggression. So the United States, which is really run by the unipolarists, like essentially the Israel lobby, these people are trying to push Russia to the brink of bankruptcy and to destabilize it. Now, the queer thing is here, you see, there are plenty of people in America who know this is dangerous and stupid. Professor John Mearsheimer of Harvard gave a wonderful lecture in which he completely destroyed the credibility of trying to beggar Russia. George F. Kennan, who's the father of containment, and the NSC 68 document of the Truman administration, who gave us our containment policy of Russia, which became national policy, I guess, for the rest of the 20th century. He said this was a ridiculous policy that is nothing, going to do nothing more than inflame Russia and provoke a reaction. The same was said by Robert Gates, the former national security advisor. And even more criminal, Henry Kissinger, of all people, came out opposed to this provocation of Russia. It seems that there's a bit of a dichotomy in the American between the pro-Americans who don't want to antagonize Russia and the unipolarists who do. And the one thing the unipolarists have in common is that they're all Zionist Jews, or they are sympathetic to Israel and are Zionist Christians. The upshot is that the Zionist influence in the United States is pushing or is responsible for the Russia-Ukrainian aggression. Now, one could argue that Putin overreacted and should not have invaded Ukraine. There's a case to be made for that, I think. But if you go back to 1979, and you find and you study what happened between the Soviet Union and Afghanistan, you can appreciate the Russian mentality. I mean, for all of its size, the Russian mentality has always been very insecure. When a coup d'etat was staged in Afghanistan in 1979, and the sadistic doctrinaire Marxist Hafizullah Amin overthrew the moderate government of Mohammad al-Taraki, the Muslims in northern Afghanistan became extremely agitated and restive. They started rioting against the government because they would not put up with the repressive anti-Muslim, pro-communist doctrinaire militarism that Amin was imposing on it. Now, for Leonid Brezhnev, this was a problem. Either he could do nothing, hope it went away, or he could go in to remove Hafizullah Amin with the Red Army and prevent the unrest from spilling over into the Soviet Union, which at the time had five Muslim republics in Central Asia. Brezhnev did not want to invade. He had better things to do, and he knew it was a risky venture. In fact, no country in this no European country in Afghanistan has come out with a victor. The British learned that the hard way in the 19th century. So when push came to shove, Brezhnev decided invasion was the lesser of two evils, and it did. And that meant that Russia had committed itself to a war it likely could not win. In the United States, the government of Jimmy Carter, under the influence of National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a dyed-in-the-wool Russophobe, convinced Carter to give money to the resistance movement in Afghanistan, which at the time also consisted of a lot of Arabs from Saudi Arabia, led by an inexperienced son of a father who had a construction company, and that son was Osama bin Laden. Money was thrown into Afghanistan to create a Vietnam for Russia, to immerse Russia in a war it couldn't win, to weaken it such that the United States would come out relatively stronger. There is a very strong parallel between that and what is going on today in Ukraine. The United States cares nothing about Ukraine. It just wants to weaken and ostracize Russia. And if you've seen the clip of American Congressman Lindsey Graham, along with John McCain and one other person in Ukraine, this was openly admitted in 2016 when Lindsey Graham told the Ukrainians, "Your battle is our battle," or "Your war is our war," or words to that effect, and that the main objective is to weaken Russia. Now, why would he say that in 2016? 6 years before Russia crossed the border? You see, this whole Ukraine scenario was in the works for a very long time. And the visual effects of it, the violence, is like the proverbial tip of the iceberg. What you don't see below the surface is what is really responsible. And the same people who brought us the Ukraine war is the same people who brought us the World Trade Center. So right now, both the Ukraine-Russia debacle and the SARS-CoV-2 debacle are being brought to you by, well, the American government. Big pharma, big Israel, big armaments, essentially designed for no other reason to make money for drug companies and to enhance American hegemony around the world.
So that's Greg Felton, the author of The Host and the Parasite, also author of SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, which, by my reckoning, is the first book published in the world to prove SARS-CoV-2 is and was a bioweapon. What do you make of his analysis of Ukraine there, Martin?
That's pretty accurate. I just picked up one thing there. He said that after the Russians had gone into Afghanistan, then the West decided to arm the Mujahideen to fight them. In actual fact, they armed the Mujahideen to fight the government before the Russians invaded in order to get the Russians to invade. And when the Russians did invade, there was a big cheer around the State Department because that was the plan, was to get the Russians to invade so that they could be given their Vietnam. So the Russians there were basically suckered into it.
The other thing is about, I mean, we played that clip with Scott Ritter a couple of weeks ago, and I've put another version of that up. It's a shortened version where he just talks about the casualties in Ukraine, which are actually astonishing. The number of civilian casualties, even the kill ratio between the Russians and Ukrainians is astonishing stuff.
Well, that's why this is a very, what the Russians call a special military operation.
They're saying 25 times less than normal civilians are being killed. The Russians are giving a list of public buildings where the Ukrainian army is holed up, and they are announcing that publicly to the world, and they're saying we're not going to attack those buildings.
Well, what they're doing, as Scott Ritter probably knows better than either of us, is they are basically wiping out the Ukrainian army. The Ukrainian army should just either surrender or their political leadership should enter into negotiations on the back of a ceasefire. That's the only way out for them.
But the trouble is there's a whole load, apparently, of CIA-placed Nazis in these positions of power within the Ukrainian military.
What they've done
at the higher levels, telling the troops on the ground what to do.
Well, yes, and don't forget the troops on the ground are trapped inside trenches and fortifications. They're very badly armed, some of them. And they can't, if you try to surrender, they will shoot you. The Russians have said, we've got evidence of people who are trying to surrender to us who are being shot by their own side.
In the back?
Yeah. And therefore you can say, well, why don't they surrender? Well, you can't. In those conditions, it's very difficult to surrender.
Well, the other thing, of course, I can remember reading about the First World War, where our soldiers, when they were going over the top, or if they refused to go over the top, were being shelled with artillery from our own side to force them to go out of the trenches
in World War II, both the NKVD and the Einsatzgruppen worked behind the front lines to shoot anybody who retreated. Yeah, this was normal. On the Eastern Front.
So Scott Ritter's leaky sites from the Ukrainian army is saying that there's 250,000 casualties now for the Ukrainian army, as against something like 50,000 casualties for the Russians, which is roughly it's probably not fair to call it a kill ratio because these are casualties, not just dead, the wounded too, about 5 to 1. So the Russians, Russian is being injured or killed for every 5 Ukrainians.
Well, there's obviously...
Or Israelis.
Dispute about what the kill ratio is, but it's definitely... The Ukrainians are on a hiding to nothing here. They've got no air cover. They're being... The Russians aren't going into frontal assaults to try and take land quickly. And so some people say, the Russians have failed because they're not winning. The Russians are doing exactly what they intended to do at their own speed. There's no rush. Because, of course, the sanctions, the whole purpose of all of this was to get sanctions on Russia, which would then crash the Russian economy. But that's turned out to be a complete failure because the Russian sanctions on a country like Russia aren't going to work.
So that presentation...
they've got everything they want within their vast territory.
That presentation...
So sanctions are just never going to work.
By Greg is going to be up on our show page, a full version of that, which is about an hour and 10 minutes long. At thisweek.org.uk includes some good questions from journalists in our HTL group at the end. And, of course, I'm pinning him down a bit on the anti-Semitism, saying, well, look, hang on a minute, you know, you're saying that Israel's to blame for all this. Do you just hate Jews? And so he gave quite a good answer on that one. A little treat for you now, Martin. You've been going on for the last few weeks about a guy called Jeffrey Sachs. Do you want to just remind us who he is? Because we're going to hear from him now.
Jeffrey Sachs is a Harvard professor of economics. He was very influential in the early 90s in Russia when I was working for CAFOD and the New Economics Foundation. He basically designed the Gaidar Plan, which was a crash privatization of the Russian economy, privatization and liberalization, which led to massive unemployment and up to 1,000% inflation simultaneously.
Yeah, he sounds like a bit of a disaster area.
Well, yes, and at the time, we all, you know, he was very much the bête noire of those who were critical of those kind of policies. But he is also, he subsequently said, well, actually, those policies would only have worked if the West was willing to come up with martial aid, you know, huge amounts of support. But I think that even if the West had been coming up, there was no force.
Yeah, maybe he was conned into that. Anyway, he seems now to be much more skeptical.
The point is, he rode back from what he did there, and he said, "Look, I got that wrong.
Sorry, everybody.
Sorry.
Oops.
Sorry, all you dead Russians that died prematurely of starvation." And
sorry
all the
for
rest of
Russia
it.
Generally for hijacking your entire industry and flogging them off.
Yeah, but anyway, he's on the board of the Lancet, which is, as you know, a very prestigious medical journal. Even though he's an economist, but I presume that he's there for a reason. And the Lancet showed a long time ago that SARS-CoV has a spike protein on it, which shows that it has been interfered with, and that he was talking to Peter Daszak about all of this, and he's saying that you're not telling me the truth about what's going on there. Now, what he's saying is it looks like this has come from a US biolaboratory where they were doing gain-of-function research, and it's escaped. Millions of people are now dead. It's a scandal. They're trying to cover it up.
Anyway,
but, of course, he doesn't go the full whole hog, which I would say is a deliberate attempt to do this.
Well, it's not just an accidental to say that, but it is interesting that someone is such a well-respected person.
No, it's important that he's spoken out, and it's not been reported in the mainstream media.
It hasn't hardly at all, has it? Interesting, that.
Even though somebody of that status saying something like that, you'd have thought somebody would pick it up.
Oh, dear. The mainstream press not doing their job again. Anyway, we have to do it for them in our little studio off Jamaica Street here in Bristol. So we can have a listen now to Jeffrey Sachs. The economist and author, as he explains, amongst other things, that he doesn't believe COVID-19 came out of any kind of natural reservoir, but came from instead a US biolab.
We have a lot we could discuss in a very short period of time, so I will summarize everything. We're in a mess. It's a mess. And we're not effectively getting out of the mess right now. Some basic points, which I'll just put on the headlines, and then we can discuss them. First, we're at the end of the U.S. leadership period. A lot of the uncertainties that we feel right now are because the United States does not and cannot lead, but Europe does not fill the void. And Latin America in recent years has been completely deinstitutionalized. Also, no help of the United States as usual, which can't even hold a meeting without a fight in which eight countries end up not showing up to Los Angeles last week. So Latin America is not in an organized state of affairs. Europe is clearly not. The U.S. has a mindset, U.S. government, that is, our state, has a mindset that it is still the world leader, which is rather preposterous given global realities, but it leads to tremendous mistakes, a failure of diplomacy, a failure to negotiate, a very harsh line against China, which is completely contrary to the actual needs of the planet, because we need cooperation everywhere. An us versus them mentality, so everybody is divided. Are you on our side or are you on the other side? We cannot function this way because every challenge we face is not about us versus them. COVID was not us versus them. It wasn't about vaccine nationalism. It wasn't about accusations. It was about getting a pandemic under control. I'll add one provocative statement. We could take it up later. It may shock you or not shock you, or you may say, I already know that, Professor Sachs. But I chaired a commission for The Lancet for 2 years on COVID. I'm pretty convinced it came out of U.S. lab biotechnology, not out of nature. Just to mention, after 2 years of intensive work on this. So it's a blunder, in my view, of biotech, not an accident of a natural spillover. We don't know for sure, I should be absolutely clear. But there's enough evidence that it should be looked into, and it's not being investigated, not in the United States, not anywhere, and I think for real reasons that they don't want to look underneath the underneath the rug too much. Well, that got us into a tremendous mess. Now we have a war that could have been avoided. It would have been avoided if the United States had not been so insistent on pushing NATO eastward and eastward and eastward. In this discussion that we sometimes have, because we don't have much of a public debate, it is claimed that the West never promised that NATO would not go eastward. Let me summarize by saying the West did promise very explicitly that NATO would not go eastward. Bill Clinton, who was not a very consequent leader for many reasons, pressure from Central European countries as well as the domestic vote, said, okay, we expand NATO eastward in the first wave. George W. Bush, who was a walking disaster from beginning to end of foreign policy, enlarged NATO 7 countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Slovakia, Slovenia, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, right up to the Russian border. And then in 2008 had the great brainstorm, well, why don't we enlarge NATO all the way to Georgia? Take a look at the map. What is that about? This was supposed to be a defensive alliance against a country that no longer exists. Now it's on the other side of the Black Sea. My feeling is they were reliving the Crimean War age, that we have to bottle up Russia in the Black Sea. Well, that was Russia's attitude. I don't blame them, whether that's right or wrong. That was their attitude. We should have negotiated. Refusal, 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 refusal to negotiate. Then came 2021. Biden came into office. Putin said, we need to negotiate this. The United States said, it's off the table. We don't negotiate this issue. I know it. I mean, I know inside what happened also. But they said no negotiation on NATO at all. 3 times in 2021, in the NATO summit, which you're about to host here in Madrid, and then in 2 declarations, one with the Defense Department and one with the State Department, the United States said, not only is NATO enlargement to Ukraine already cooked in, but we are increasing the military capacity. We're sending billions of dollars of arms. Okay, you don't think that's provocative? It's provocative. So we don't discuss those things, because when I say those things in the United States, A, I can't get even published in an op-ed piece, which is usually something that is not quite an issue for me, having written thousands. And because no one wants to discuss these issues. No debate. Please, next week when you host NATO here, don't just say, oh yes, United States, you're so wise. Or, oh yes, we pour more weapons into Ukraine so that more can be destroyed. Please don't do that. Because European leaders have known for 14 years how dangerous that is, but they don't say it. I'd say all the European leaders, except for the UK, which knows nothing, unfortunately, because all they know is follow the US. But the rest know. This is not right. This is dangerous. We need to negotiate. We need a different approach. Russia needs to leave, but we don't need to enter afterwards. So if we actually discussed, there's an agreement to be reached. But the point, by the way, is not to push Zelensky to discuss with Putin. That's meaningless. It's the U.S. to discuss with Putin. That's the only negotiation that counts. What can Zelensky offer? The idea that we sit back and let Zelensky negotiate is an absurdity. It's a dodge of responsibility. The one responsible is the U.S. president. He should discuss. also in a multilateral setting, because this really should be handled by the UN Security Council, which is not impossible. The veto issue doesn't apply here because there's no meaning to anything unless Russia also agrees. So we need an agreement where we negotiate within the UN Security Council framework. China can be a constructive part of this agreement. And that raises another issue. The United States is on a war path with China.
Fascinating, I think, analysis by Jeffrey Sachs. Thanks very much, Martin, for bringing him to our attention. What an interesting guy, journalist and economist, someone who's been actually at the heart of trying to crunch through the journalism at the Lancet of what's been going on with COVID, has now come down on our side, really.
Yes, and of course, I agree with virtually everything he says there. It's, and from somebody like him who's been at the heart...
It was just an accidental leak,
Yeah, I mean, but don't forget, it's good that he's gone the halfway of saying that.
Of course.
Because it opens the door to asking further questions.
Yes, he's saying it needs much more investigation, yes. And he's come to the conclusion that's the most likely outcome.
Yeah.
I'd just add on
top of that, we know from the times of Israel that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States told the Israeli Defense Forces in November 2019 that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. That suggests to me that somebody had foreknowledge. You don't get foreknowledge of accidental leaks. What's beginning to become clearer, and no doubt the history books will be written, provided we don't destroy ourselves, is that this was all an orchestrated attack to try and take down the Chinese economy before it grew to a size where it couldn't be.
Yeah, it's an act of war, really.
The Chinese
have been quite nice to Taiwan, considering, aren't they?
They are, because they obviously both Russia and China do not want a nuclear war. So they're not going to do it. And if you're dealing with a maniac, you've got to be very careful about what you do, because the maniac might not be rational. So that's why they've got to play their cards very close to their chest. Even if there's an interesting thing. I nearly sent you the tweet. A minister in the Chinese government, the foreign minister, he's a junior minister. He put a tweet out this week, basically accusing the US of carrying out 9/11. So that's an official Chinese spokesperson. Now, the way they handle their public relations will be, he will have been given, all right, it's time for you to start talking about 9/11. Now, they haven't said anything about it up to now. But if you're going to be nasty to us, then we'll start talking about what happened there. And, of course, this is the 9/11 truth movement. I've always said to the 9/11 truth, it won't be us that exposes this. It'll be the political opponents of the Western regime. It'll suddenly become in their interest for all this to come out, and it will come out.
Yes, I think this is one of the problems. If the US, as he's saying there, just doesn't want to do negotiations, well, then there's no reason to keep these things under wraps, is there? It's all going to come out.
And also it's just a little tweet. It's got some pictures, you know, and it says, people are like, countries are like people. They need self-awareness. So it says, Japan thinks America does this. And it's got a picture of Hiroshima. You know, Iraq thinks America does this. It's pictures of all the places that have been destroyed. America thinks itself as Superman. And what America really does is Twin Towers.
Twin Towers, yeah. Fascinating. Well, it's interesting.
A straw in the wind that the Chinese government official would tweet that. He won't have done it without discussing it with his superiors.
No, most definitely not. No, fascinating. Anyway, so in a way, what's happening is, I suppose the Russians and the Chinese are starting to take over where WikiLeaks has left off. And, that they've started the ball rolling there in getting a lot of this information out. And now the US is, and the Brits with them, the Anglo-Zionist Empire, they're all sitting together thinking, right, well, we're going to have to take on the Chinese and the Russians. Well, actually, if you're going to stop journalism in your own part of the world, of course the Russians and Chinese are going to share that information.
Yes, I mean, it's just ultimately about the balance of power and forces. The West has ruled the roost for so long that the people in charge think that they've got a right to rule forever. And the world has changed. The Chinese was a very poor, China was a very poor country in the 1940s after, decades and decades of being dominated by foreign interests. And they have built themselves up to be basically as strong as the United States. If China and the United States went to war, and if it didn't go nuclear, the Chinese would win. Because they're just, you know, that's the reality of it, especially if they're fighting on their own turf. If they tried to attack the United States, they'd lose. But defending their own turf, they're unbeatable. The same with the Russians. You're not going to beat them on their home ground. It's hopeless.
Another bit of news just before you wind up. Dr. Fauci's decided to step down. I wonder if the testimony of Jeffrey Sachs, the book by Robert Kennedy, these sorts of things, it's eventually he's decided, look, it's just I'm going to have to leave. Or maybe he's been told. What do you think about Fauci going?
Well, I don't really know, but I think that Sachs singles out Fauci and Daszak as people who weren't telling him the truth. He was actually talking to them, and he sent Daszak to investigate what happened. And then he said, "Well, Andrew, you didn't tell me that you'd been funding this research in the Wuhan lab," which of course was then exposed by Tucker Carlson,
which is actually potentially most criminal. Really, I mean, you know, you think about the effect that it's had around the world. It's massive.
Even if it was an accident, it's DARPA, the Pentagon, which created this biological agent. But it wasn't an accident. And we're going to have some kind of Nuremberg trial at the end of all of this, aren't we?
Well, yes. Now, our final clip tonight is from Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, the Orthodox Jewish doctor of Donald Trump, who used this expression, the poison death shots, to talk about... COVID vaccines. He's really not wasn't into them. He died about a month or so ago, but I just love this guy. I think he's one of the most fantastic figures I've ever come across. His turn of phrase, his sardonic humor. So we're going to finish with him tonight, and here he is talking to Israeli politicians and their health minister about the COVID vaccines.
There are three levels of safety or death that we need to look at. One is acute, one is subacute, and long-term. Acute, I'll define from the moment of injection till 3 months. The number one risk of the shot is blood clots, just like Dr. Yudin said, according to the Salk Institute. By the way, everything I'm saying, I will defend with documentation, and please don't take my word for it. You should do your due diligence. And I can provide for you proof for everything that I'm saying. According to the Salk Institute, when a person gets an injection of these vaccines, quote unquote, the body becomes a spike producing factory, making trillions of spikes, which migrate to the endothelium, which is the inner lining of your blood vessels, and is basically little thorns on the inside of your vasculature. As the blood cells flow through it, they get damaged, they cause blood clots. If that happens in the heart, it's a heart attack. If that happens in the brain, that's a stroke. So we're seeing the number one cause of death in the short term is from blood clots, and most of it is happening within the first 3-4 days. 40% is happening within the first 3 days of injection of this poison death shot. Now, the other problem is that it's causing myocarditis or inflammation in the hearts of children, and young adults, I'm sorry, in the hearts of young adults. And the third problem, which is the most disturbing, is according to the New England Journal of Medicine article, their preliminary data, the miscarriage rate in the first trimester, a woman gets vaccinated in the first trimester goes from 10% to 80%. I want you to understand what I just said. The miscarriage rate in the first trimester of pregnant women, when they get vaccinated, goes up by a factor of 8. That's preliminary data. It may change with time, but I'm just telling you what it is as of today. That's the smallest of the problem. The second problem is the subacute death issue, which is the following, that the animal studies that were done with these vaccines show that all the animals responded well in generating antibodies. When they were challenged, however, with the virus that they were immunized against, a large percentage of them died. And when that was investigated, it was found that their immune system had killed them. It's called something antibody-dependent enhancement or pathogenic priming or paradoxical immune enhancement. But the point is that a lot of those animals died. So you can make an argument, maybe human beings are different. My answer to you, maybe. However, those studies were not done. You are the study right now. The Pfizer CEO said Israel is the biggest laboratory in the world. And so those long-term studies to rule out Dr. Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for the discovery of HIV, said that this is the biggest risk to humanity and the biggest risk of genocide in the history of humanity. And so the risk of a ADE reaction in human beings, which happens later, has not been ruled out. So my question is, why would I vaccinate someone with a potentially destructive, lethal substance without ruling that out first? And the third component here is the long-term consequences. There is definite evidence that it affects fertility, damages ovarian function, that it reduces sperm counts, number one. Number two, definitely increases the amount of autoimmune diseases. Who knows over time how that is going to reduce lifespan? And just last week, a paper came out showing that increases the risk of cancer. So any way you want to look at it, whether in the acute setting where it causes blood clots, inflammation of the heart, and miscarriages, in the midterm subacute setting where it can result in a pathological, disastrous immune reaction, or in the long term, whether it causes increased autoimmune diseases, cancer, and infertility. Now, that's a big concern. Actually, I'll say it this way. In my opinion, the current Israeli government is a Gilgul of Joseph Mengele. They've permitted human experimentation on their own people. And I'm going to tell you, I hope this basin is a little different, maybe not, but I know I finally understood what Chazal say, that if you see Tzuras and Klal Yisrael, you should look at the Dayan Yisrael, Masechta Shabbos. That if you see trouble in the Jewish people, you should look at the rabbinic leadership, because if the head is diseased, what do you expect of the body? So I beg of this basin to put the interests of Klal Yisrael above politics and anything else that may alter your opinions. I received daily death threats. I risked my life, my career, my financial life, my reputation, almost my family, everything, just to sit here and tell you what I'm telling you. So I'll just summarize it, that there is no need for this vaccine. And there's actually no need for anyone. And I'll explain. Children, I already told you, they have a 99.998% chance of getting better. Young adults from 18 to 45 have a 99.95% of getting better. This is according to the CDC, same concept. Someone who has already COVID and has antibodies, naturally induced immunity is a billion times more effective than artificially induced immunity through vaccine. So why would I vaccinate someone with a poison death shot that makes inferior or dangerous antibodies when I already have healthy antibodies? And then if you look at the high risk population that has a 7.5% death rate, so my data, which was the first in the world, which I published in a peer-reviewed journal, which has become the basis of over 200 other studies, and that have corroborated my observations that if you treat people in the right time frame, you reduce death rate by 85%. So out of 600,000 Americans, we could have prevented 510,000 from going to the hospital and dying. And by the way, I presented this information to Bibi Netanyahu directly into his hands by way of a shliach in April of 2020. And I informed every single member of your Ministry of Health as well. So my question to you is, if I can reduce the death rate from 7.5% to less than 0.5%, why would I use a poison death shot that doesn't work and has tremendous and horrific side effects? And I'll do one more mind experiment with you. If everyone on the planet were to get COVID and not get treated, the death rate globally will be less than 0.5%.
So that's Rabbi Zev Zelenko, the great philosopher, Orthodox Jewish critic of the poison death jab, and, by the way, doctor to Donald Trump too. One family that Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, Eichmann and Stefan Bandera missed because he was born in Kiev. Absolutely brilliant stuff. And I'll put the full interview there up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk from Zev Zelenko, Dr. Zev Zelenko, actually. His father was a rabbi, but I mean, he just talks like a preacher there in a fantastic, brilliant way. It's also this week, it's the Earth First Gathering down in South Petherton. Best of luck to them. They're environmental activists, and it'd be interesting to know, you know, how much of the environment they're really going to be helping and how much of the zero COVID agenda they're going to be pushing, because I notice there's a lot of pressure on all these sort of green groups to become zero COVID groups and become Extinction Rebellion groups rather than actually to look after the environment in a normal fashion. They're just trying to push it into some kind of new green system where everyone's got to have carbon credits, and it's a kind of new economic world, really. But that isn't actually what environmental protection is really about, looking after creation. Anyhow, time to sign off now. Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, as you heard a couple of today via there. Particularly on the Merseyside police and their misbehaviour. You'll also find the podcast there, the full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses if you want to email Martin or I. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list, which has got stories and links to the stories and even a few pictures on there, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperback's about the deals between the Nazis and the Allies during the war. The Traitors of Arnhem, that book is £15. You can get it on eBay or go via Bilderberg.org to get the various links to that, including the free version and the ebook. Also, my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination. That's £20. The Siege of Heaven Reader, also on eBay. At Bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week here on this the talkradio.org.uk stream, and also over Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. So please also do make live recordings in case we get deleted or ours disappear. Our live recordings get disappeared. So we've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol, at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. Censorship and military disinformation is sadly the norm in Britain today from the London media, thanks to the collaborators who own those transmitters and printing presses and the centralisers of power who seem to love to put everything in London, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us or broadcast, please let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.